I get thanked, but those guys are the heroes. I also had some friends who were platoon leaders in Vietnam, and those are the real unsung heroes, those that survived, and because they were in the thick of it. And anybody who knows folks in the infantry, in the Marines or the Army, know that that's true. Far more risky duty than I had, but I'm proud to have done it. In any case, I got out of the Navy, went to business school, got an MBA, and decided to stay around for a year and write cases for one of my professors, which was a really, really valuable educational experience. I managed to get through business school on money saved in the Navy and the GI Bill, which was tuitions were a lot lower in those days, and so the GI Bill was very good for that, and I managed to save. Well, today it's not very much money, but back then it was fairly significant. You don't have really a lot of opportunities to spend money when you're on deployment. So I stayed on for a year, wrote cases. I had a professor who was very persuasive. He suggested that maybe I ought to think about going to the doctoral program, and I said no possibility of that. I mean, I was interested in doing business, not studying about it. But he was persuasive, and one thing led to another, and I got interested in a particular topic, so I stayed on and finished a doctorate in 1980. I went from there to a consulting company in New York and worked there for 5 or 6 years, and then went to back to Boston in venture capital, and then started my own essentially venture capital private equity company in Boston in the mid-'80s. And that was a really great time because technology companies were springing up around Route 128 in New England all over the place, and so there were lots of potential clients. Moved to Wyoming in 1999 and became a member of the Wyoming Business Council in 2002. I say I moved to Wyoming. The reason I could do that and still do business was because of the internet and the communications ability that that provided. And I'll come back to that theme because that would not have been possible in 1990, for example, but by 1999, 2000, even with dial-up, you could actually do a lot of kinds of business from Wyoming, and that continues to the present day. Over the course of time, I've been a director of a number of privately owned and publicly traded companies, and so that's the doing of that has given me an appreciation for the roles that you play. Very broadly, that's what a legislature does in a state. It's also what a board of trustees does in a university. There are responsibilities and prerogatives that go along with that, and those responsibilities and prerogatives, I would say, are not well understood in the society in general or in the organizations that are governed by them very often, but they are there nonetheless, and that's the role that you play and that the Board of Trustees plays with respect to the university.
One thing, Dick, before you President Ross, would you like to come up here and sit with us? Or you? Okay, go ahead.
I met Brent Hathaway, Dean of the College of Business, in 2005, I believe it was. And we talked about the possibility of my doing some adjunct teaching at the college when time permitted, and I was interested in that, but time never permitted until I finished my major. I was chairman of a company, an oil and gas company, actually, exploration company, and based in Calgary. It was publicly traded in the United States and in Canada. The company was pretty much of a wreck when I joined the board. I did it only as a favor to a friend, actually the brother of a friend, but we managed to turn the company around and in the space of 4 years, well enough so that it became a hostile takeover target by a large Canadian oil and gas company. I was angered at that time by the fact that the Canadian company was, the would-be acquirer was trading on what is known in the legal vernacular as material non-public information. Or in other words, it was trading on insider information it had but that other investors didn't have. And it had that information as a result of having been the Canadian National Oil Company a few years before. You may remember that there was a time when Canada went through a a pretty socialistic phase, and so all the natural resources or the companies that were producing them were nationalized to one degree or another, and Petro-Canada, which was the former Canadian National Oil Company, at one point had gathered all of the well data on every well that had been drilled in Canada, and then they were privatized. But all that well data was still an asset of the company. As a result of having been the former National Oil Company, however, they were supposed to make that information available to at least those who had produced it. So in the case of the company, my company, it would have been wells that we had drilled, and with all the well logs and the reservoir calculations and so on. Petro-Canada was aware of something like a trillion cubic feet of natural gas that once upon a time, under previous accounting rules, had been an asset of Canada Southern, which is the company on whose board I was. But change of accounting rules made those reserves not reportable or claimable on annual financial statements. Nevertheless, Petro-Canada knew it, and gas prices at that time were high, and prospects for their rising were good. And it was a major effort to extract that information, which was from at least 15 years prior, a major project to extract that information from Petro-Canada, and they did not make it easy. But in any case, I'm digressing from the main theme of the story. But we managed to get the information. We managed to reveal it to the markets in a way that was legal, and much to the chagrin of Petro-Canada. And in the end, the shareholders did very well, as they were entitled to do. But getting back to the main theme, I finished that project in early 2007 and thought about what I would like to do next, because I had a little bit of spare time for a change. And I called Dean Hathaway and said, I could do some teaching if you need a spare finance prof. And at that point, he was in the process of getting the Daniels Fund to endow a chair in business ethics at the College of Business. And said he thought I should think about doing that. And never one to turn down an interesting challenge. It turns out that's kind of a theme in my life, I guess. But I decided to give it a whirl, just maybe for a few years, to see what it would be like. It was also interesting because when I was in business school, there were no courses in business ethics or corporate governance or anything like that. So I thought I'd learn something myself in the doing of it. And I agreed I'd do it for 3 years, and then 3 years led to 6 years. And then there was a leadership change at the university, and then new president Bob Sternberg asked me if I'd serve as provost, or for those of you unfamiliar with the university jargon, that's vice president of academic affairs, which is, in business terms, is basically the chief operating officer of a university. All of the academic programs and the academic staff report up to the vice president of academic affairs. And again, not having done that before, but thinking it seemed to be an interesting challenge. And also, I was really curious about applying some business concepts to the management of a university. I decided to take that on. And you know, the rest of the history, or at least the outlines of it, turned out that President Sternberg was not the best fit in terms of personality or focus for the university. Although, to give credit to him, he did subscribe very strongly to the land grant mission of the university, and articulated it very well, I think.
Dick, that's one of the things that we might have you visit a little bit about too, is because, and it's interesting that you come from the business background, which I think is a real positive thing for the university. And there was that article, and it was in either Forbes or Fortune, and in fact they mentioned Bob Sternberg, talked about how different it is to be a CEO whether it's IBM or a small company like mine, relative to being a president of a university. What a challenge. You know, one of the things that I think that a lot of us, and I'm speaking for, maybe for me, but we thought the university was not really aligned with what we thought was the mission for the state of Wyoming in different directions and those kind of things. And I think the Board of Trustees, when they went out to interview a president, had some things in mind about a direction that they wanted to see the university go. And we got two of them here. They can certainly comment on that. And I think that, that Bob started down a path that at least I was comfortable with, not knowing all the inner workings. So I'd be interested in your comments about the direction of the university, sort of the way it was going with the previous president, 137 days, I think, or whatever it was, and how you see that now from this point forward relative to the situation. And really, in a lot of ways, it's a positive thing to step into a situation like this with the type of background you have and be able to articulate and continue this direction and mission. So maybe you could speak a little bit about that and where you see us going relative to the changes that were made. And I hope a lot of those will be continued. I think those are positive things for the university, but, you know, I might be in the minority on that. And let us know what you think. And then, of course, if the Board of Trustees would like to say something about that, that's certainly welcome. So what do you think? Could you kind of get into that a little bit?
Yes, with Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, that is a major piece of what I intend to be talking about here this morning, too. So let me just finish up on the biographical part, if I may, and then we'll move right on to that. But to just to finish up on the biographical part, that brings us up to date on sort of my professional background, a little bit about the Wyoming background. I mentioned the Wyoming Business Council. Back in the 90s, I started spending a lot of time in Fremont County and north of Dubois, and the thing that really appealed to me about that country was how wild and remote it was, and just figuring out how to get along in that sort of environment was just fascinating to me. And that it was in that period of time that I hunted for the first time, and with some encouragement from a grizzly old outfitter who really knew what he was doing and saw some potential in me, I guess. But he urged me to apply for a guide license, which I did, and went ahead and got it. So, bought with a small group of people, bought an old dude ranch north of Dubois, and then bought a small place in Crowheart to keep the horses in the winter. So over the course of time, it's just been more and more Wyoming in a variety of ways. And I used to think it was the scenery, but it's really the people. I just really like the people. You know, they are what you see, and they say that they speak their minds. And I'll tell you, the people in Crowheart, I've got three neighbors, three abutters. Two are tribal members, and one is one of us, so to speak. But all three of them are just the hardest working people I've ever seen, and I really, really admire them. They don't ask much from anybody. They just ask for a consistent set of rules to go by from the federal agencies they have to deal with. And for the rest of it, they'll just say, you know, we'll take care of ourselves. And it's really admirable, and I just like being in the company of those folks. So any questions about
It's sort of ironic, you know, the former chairman, Senator Nicholas, the president of the university was in his district, and I think you're in my district. I'm not sure that really means anything. But anyway, welcome, Mr. Constituent. Anybody have any questions of the president? Please continue.
That's an interesting observation, though, Mr. Chairman. As a constituent or a voter, I suppose it could be said that you are responsible to me, among many others. But then
you could say that.
I can say that. That's right. But in my professional role, I am certainly responsible to the Board of Trustees and to you, and we can be very clear about that. So let's get to the university. I think it would be worthwhile to sort of summarize my views of it from both an external and an internal point of view. I was not on the inside of any academic institution. Well, you could say at Harvard Business School I was as a research associate, but research associates are essentially slaves, and you don't really pay too much attention to university administration or management, and you don't have time, and you really it really is irrelevant because you don't have any influence over it anyway. So I never really paid attention to it. As a professor of business ethics, I taught courses, and as a professor in a college, in a department teaching a set number of courses, you have a fairly narrowly constrained view. I mean, you've got your courses and the content of them and how well you're teaching them and the students that are taking them. That's really your focus. To some degree, there is research involved, and there is also a significant amount of public service involved. At least there was in my case. And so your view is fairly narrow. It was not until Bob Sternberg asked me to serve as Vice President of Academic Affairs did I begin to get an overall view of the university and how it operates and where it's maybe stronger and maybe where it's not so strong. And so that was only in really middle of August. But in the course of the next few months, I learned a whole lot about its workings, the quality of the faculty, the quality of the programs, and the quality of the administrative team that is in the university. Administrative team defined as the vice presidents that you see here today, the deans of the various colleges and their associate deans. That's really the management team of a university as compared to the management team of a business. And so seeing that in a holistic way was very interesting and very educational. And is everyone hearing me all right? By the way, I'm not sure about the right distance here from the microphone, but I don't want to explode your eardrums either. So with that experience, what do I think about the university? I think it's got great students and students who love the place, as the senator does, and you other graduates do too, I expect. They really love it, and they love it because it's a beautiful place to be, but also the attention they get from the faculty is, for the most part, is pretty good. We can talk about how it could be better, but it's pretty good, and they learn a lot. And they know that the university is there for them, so that's a nice combination. It's got a very good faculty. This is one of the things I learned in the course of serving as in academic affairs for 4 months. There is world-class brain power on the property there, and the potential of the research that they do is staggering. And we'll be talking about that during the course of today. Bill Gurin knows that very well, and he'll have a few words to say about it. But it's really remarkable. I mean, it makes you kind of jittery about some of the potential of it for purpose of doing good, not just for Wyoming, but for a variety of major problems that face Wyoming, the country, and the world as a whole. They are excellent researchers and they're excellent teachers. The university itself as an institution, and you all may take this for granted, but it's really something to think about, to be conscious of. You all know that the university is the only four-year institution in the state. But what's the meaning of that? What it means is that the state can focus whatever resources it wants to focus on higher education, it can focus it on one place. And that is quite different from most other states across the country, where not only is there a land-grant institution, but there is a flagship university. So, for example, University of Michigan is a flagship research university, but it receives a very small amount of public support. But then there's Michigan State, which is renowned for a lot of things. It's a land-grant college, and so their missions are somewhat different. But Wyoming has one, and that puts the University of Wyoming in a particularly favored spot, but also a spot with a lot of responsibility to the state and to the people. But that is that's an important aspect of it, and it is a strength of the university, and I think it's a strength that the state has that helps the state be as fiscally responsible as it is. Because in the other states, you have any number of universities within a university system, and there's a university system in Michigan where you'll have six or seven major universities that are competing with each other for resources and students. There is probably overcapacity in higher education in the United States today, in some areas, but that's a problem that Wyoming has not created for itself, and that's good, and it's a strength of the university. I know that there is frustration with the university from time to time over the course of time, from various quarters. But that frustration reflects the high expectations that the state has for the university and the expectations of it. But there's an enormous amount of affection for the university across the state, and that's the university is fortunate to have it. And finally, there's been an enormous support from the legislature over the course of time and the governor, and the university is fortunate to have had that over the course of time, and needs to do everything it can to justify that and to promote it. In some specific areas where I think the university is particularly good are in undergraduate education generally, but also in geology, economics. The undergraduate engineering program is particularly good. I'd say it's the my colleague Khalid Gossam is here and can tell you more about it, but it is surely the most rigorous undergraduate program on the campus, and it's the graduates show it in the jobs they get and the positions they achieve over their professional careers. There is, as I said before, there's world-class research brain power. At the university, in areas like atmospheric sciences, computational sciences, water resources, and other areas that we can talk about. And as I said, Professor Bill Gern will be talking about that a little bit later. There are challenges there. It's a difficult, as I said, a university all by itself, and a land grant in particular, is a difficult animal to manage. A private university, privately funded university like a Princeton or a Harvard where I went, has a much narrower mission. They can pick and choose amongst their students. They can appeal to donors with vast financial resources to fund practically anything they want, and they do that, and they do that successfully. Land grant mission is a much broader mission, as you know from, I'm sure you've read the Morrill Land Grant Act and the Wyoming Constitution. The purpose of our land-grant university is to provide an education to undergraduates that is nearly free as possible. And that's a challenge we're wrestling with right now. But that's what a management team is for, to try and figure out how to do that. But at the same time, the university has this flagship mission, which means that it's got research responsibilities. If it's going to be respected by its peer institutions, and if it's going to be respected by the faculty it wants to recruit, it's got to be strong in research, and it's got to be focused in the way it does it. And that's what one of the things we'll be talking about today, too. And in connection with that, one of the research missions is to focus not on silos, not on specific disciplines or departments, but to focus on problems that are complicated, and that in order to address them, you need a combination of disciplines being applied to them, and that's the real challenge of a research university, and here we have one that is both. So the management issues get very interesting. Continuing on to the questions that the chairman was asking about, let me say some things about the university management and leadership. You have been living it. I was sort of, as a professor, was vaguely aware of it, but not paying particularly close attention, although I was sort of curious about it from a management standpoint. But I think the previous university admission was administration was less responsive to the state's needs and priorities than it could have been. And I think there was increasing pressure over the course of time for it to for the university to be more responsive. I think the histories of the School of Engineering Resources, the attracting of NCAR to the state, and most recently the Wyoming the governor's energy and engineering and STEM task force, the response to those, let's say, requests or urgings from the state were slow and reluctant, I think, or at least indifferent or unenthusiastic. There, some people would probably apply more, stronger adjectives about it to those situations than I did, but that was the reality. But the governor and the legislature have been increasingly insistent, and that insistence is what has led to the leadership change that's happened over the last year. Going back to the resignation of President Buchanan, and I wrote I want to read this because I was in trying to distill this. I wanted to try and state this as concisely and clearly as possible. So I just want to read what I had to say about this. The unenthusiastic response to the wishes of the governor and the legislature led to the recent leadership changes in UW. The philosophy of the Board of Trustees and the management team now in place are very different from a year ago and even 6 months ago. UW now has a leadership team intent on pursuing the land grant and flagship missions of the university and to growing the economy of the state and to improving the lives of its people. That's a more explicit statement of what the university is all about than I think the previous administration would have been comfortable in saying. I'll finish here and then go to some more specific questions, which I'm sure you have. But so we have this a focused board of trustees. We have basically new leadership in the university. What are the near-term priorities? We need, and there are five or maybe six because one part of them is a major one. But there needs to be we need to be implementing our plans to improve retention, student retention, recruitment, completion, and employment rates so that we're fulfilling the real land grant mission of the university, which is to educate students to be productive, ethical contributors to society. Let me mention as an example this retention issue. University retention is the percentage of students that begin freshman year that continue on and begin the sophomore year. University of Wyoming retention rate is approximately 74% or so, 75. By contrast, our great competitor to the south, Colorado State's retention rate is approximately 85. That's where we need to be. A retention rate of 74 basically means that that differential is money lost or money wasted. The money spent on educating these folks, at least for a part of a year, who don't stay. And that happens because, well, it can happen for a variety of reasons. There are societal reasons, there are motivational reasons in the students, but they are addressable. And that's something, that is a major priority that we have right now, and it's for the benefit of the students.
Dick, in that vein, while we're on that particular subject, and I really appreciate, you know, land-grant university has a mission that's consistent with what land-grant universities do, and then Wyoming is further, exacerbated that situation because we are one. We have one. And then you look at other land-grant universities. Some of them are, I mean, there's one like Michigan State, and it's a whole different situation. You know, we are not a Harvard or an Ivy League school, mm-hmm. and so we have to do things differently. When you talk about retention, how do we compare to a typical, I would call them a typical university private type, where they go from the second or their freshman to sophomore years? Are they probably 90-95%? Is that where they would be?
I would believe so, yes. I haven't looked at the numbers myself, but that's what I would expect. Their admissions process is very different. They pride themselves on the small percentage of admits that they grant, and these people are ordinarily very high IQ. They may not necessarily be people that you would feel comfortable spending a lot of time with because they're so focused on their studies or so intellectual. I mean, there's some normal people there too, but.
But you get that quote, Bob.
One of the things they do is they try and recruit the very, very brightest people they can, and they educate them in the way that they do. The retention rates tend to be very high because once you're admitted, you might be surprised at how the standards are not. Let's say the grading standards are not as strict as the admission standards. So they're starting with really, really bright people to begin with, and then those people, and to some degree, can get carried along. I mean, I'm not saying it's hard to flunk out, but if you do a moderate amount, you can get by. So the retention rates are pretty good.
You know, one of the things that I think the legislature and the citizens of Wyoming really made a conscious effort to do, and it gets back to land-grant philosophy, retention, is the Hathaway Scholarship.
Yeah.
And I got to believe, and I haven't looked at percentages where we were in retention before the Hathaway, but I've got to believe that's been a positive influence on our students that go down to the university within Wyoming, our Wyoming kids.
I would think so. It's just one of the best things. It's another one of those great things about Wyoming.
Fortunately, we can do that.
That's right. And just to be clear, we think Hathaway scholarships are great, and we wouldn't mind seeing more of them. But we'll get to that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, and that sort of talking about this retention issue brings up something I've been wrestling with a little bit. I noted in the governor's message he talks about and sort of promotes the idea that, you know, we have the third highest percent per capita of residents with high school diplomas, but then you look at the other end of the spectrum and we're among the lowest among the states for college graduates per capita. And, you know, that sort of disconnect, the tale of two states, and I've always been a big advocate of having one university, focusing our resources on one university, but it does make me question a little bit about whether the way we've done it is in the past is the most effective for the state, and whether, and I know you're going to be talking about some of these outreach issues and cooperative efforts with community colleges, but whether we really need to be looking at that more, because there does seem to be a disconnect in, you know, K through 12 and collegiate education in the state.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say three things in response to it. Excuse me. First of all, you all know Wyoming better than I do, or at least your parts of it. But the students grow up in small towns, and very often in agricultural settings. And I am not saying that they don't aspire to do great things or seek challenges, because they do, but their experience is fairly limited, and many of them, and I say this firsthand from being in the classroom, many of them do not realize how far they can go and what they can accomplish if they just dream about it a little bit. And the most important thing in my mind that a faculty of an institution like this can do is to encourage them to believe that they can be whatever they want to be. They've got the brain power and they've got the work ethic, but they may not understand. Many of them are first-time college attendees. They may not just understand how what opportunities are out there for them if they'll just think about it and give it a try. And I'll tell you, it's one of the most thrilling things for a professor is to see that light go on in the eyes of, I'm thinking of a young woman in particular from Lusk, who just, it just happened one time. And I'm not taking sole credit for it, but this is the kind of thing that goes on in the university, and we need to do a better job of accomplishing this. But, and that's my point, too. But you know, to see, she said, I just thought I'd go to college and then marry my high school sweetheart and go back home, but I'm not. I don't have to do that. I'm going to go to Europe, and I'm going to get a job. And because one of the university's travel abroad programs, she went to Europe for, I think, three weeks or 4 weeks over a semester break one time, and it changed her life. It just, the world opened up, and that's what this kind of university is supposed to be able to do. When I say this, that's what this is, university is supposed to be able to do, it's supposed to give these young folks an idea of what the opportunities are out for them beyond Wyoming, as well as within, and how to pursue them. And so that's a very, very important thing to do. So that's point one. Point two, delivering that sort of result, delivering that sort of encouragement to students is in a large, again, now think of this as a business organization, but delivering that sort of education or getting students to believe that is something we can do a lot better. And we're attempting to do it better in the semester starting, we're piloting it in the semester starting this fall, but it's going to go into full effect in the fall of 15, but it's this university studies program where we're taking freshmen and basically giving them a course in something called the Freshman Seminar that attempts to do exactly this, among other things. Give them an idea of what is available out them, what opportunities are available out there for them to pursue. And that is a job that we can do very well. We should be able to do very well, but you have to be focused on it. And you have to focus the faculty on doing that kind of thing, in addition to all the other things they're doing. But that is doable. And then finally, bringing back people to the university, alumni, who have experienced that insight or realization in the course of their college careers and have gone out and done it, and then bringing them back and having them talk to the students from Riverton or Franny or Opal or any number of places across the state. I think that's what accomplishes what you're getting at, I believe. Does that help with?
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
not
go ahead.
Not to delay this anymore, but just to kind of keep working that line of question. I think the thing, and maybe it's a Casper issue or a Riverton issue, but we have some other population centers in the state, and it's and to move us from second to last in college-educated citizens. I mean, there's more to the story, too. I mean, many of these young folks have to leave Wyoming, lack of economic, for a job
mm-hmm.
when they're done at the university. But there's this part of this that, you know, some of the education programs are being now done at UWCC, and perhaps they're maybe better done there. There's more schools, more opportunities, more. You're in the center of the state geographically and then population-wise. I think some of the medical education issues, Cheyenne and Casper, are, you know, have those larger places. You've got a whole group of kind of a younger population in Gillette and what's happening at Gillette College. And so I think that outreach has got to be crucial. I think folks shouldn't have to give up everything. And I know they don't, but it's at some point they got to come to Laramie. And it's just too hard. I mean, it's too hard for folks in different situations in a 400-mile trip from Park County.
Yeah, Ms. Chairman.
So I think that's where we're coming from, and I think what the time is to do that. And the significant investments we've made in our community colleges, where most of our citizens are, in fact, educated in higher ed. So I think that's got to be a key partnership moving forward.
Dick?
Mr. Chairman, I agree. That should have been a point four. But the way I've thought about that is in the following way. And it's this, and I'm not sure why it exists other than it's human nature, probably, and managerial short-sightedness, perhaps. But there is this silo mentality that seems to me to exist as between K-12 community colleges and the university. It should be a continuous process that works way more smoothly than it does. And for reasons that I don't fully understand yet, it doesn't. And what's one of the important things about the governor's energy, engineering, and STEM task force is this STEM dimension of it. And and I think we all know the STEM is the science and technological and engineering and math disciplines. That mandate by the governor, that directive basically to make that work better, addresses this compartmentalized thinking that seems to go on at these different levels, which you probably know much better about than I, dealing with all these, you know, this whole continuum of things. In my business ethics teaching, I was responsible for. I worked with community colleges on articulating a single course, meaning how do we get business ethics courses in the community colleges to count for credit at the university. That can be done simply or maybe not at all. It comes down to depending upon do the individuals in the university and the community colleges have a half-decent personal relationship. It seems to me it shouldn't be left to chance like that. That's one example. Another example is the partnership between CADA and Casper College on the subject of CADA identifying for Casper College administration to consider degree programs there in Casper College which will directly benefit the economy in the Casper area. And in that regard, in fact, included in the budget, we'll get to that a little bit later, but in that regard, the University of Wyoming Casper College Center, which is in process of being renamed University of Wyoming at Casper College, but there the university administration, the Casper College administration, and the K-12 system there in Casper are working together on a single degree program, which is medical laboratory technology, a bachelor's in that. And if we do that right, it basically creates a model or a template that could be rolled out across the state. And the opportunities for doing that are enormous. And it addresses the issue you're getting at, which is there are a lot of people out there in the state with really solid brain power and ambition that can't get to Laramie. Well, they should not be penalized. And this STEM aspect of the governor's initiative creates, a testing ground or a laboratory for purposes of, I would hope, breaking down this silo mentality that seems to exist within the three levels of the educational system in Wyoming. And this is another thing, though, that Wyoming really has going for it, because the population is small. We all know each other. We all know who is doing what. And that is not the case in other states. And so in a situation where, even though you'd wish it weren't, personal relationships are important, they can be brought to bear in concentrated areas like this so that we can achieve some effect. But again, from the managerial standpoint of the university, you have to direct people's attention to that and find ways of making them make it work. And the administrations of university, community colleges, and K-12 systems need to operate the same way.
You know, we really want to hear your philosophy, and yet being a military guy, we've got a schedule we're going to try to keep. And, of course, you know, we can stay here as long as it takes. This is pretty important, but it's 9 o'clock, and we were going to try to have you gentlemen out of here and ladies by noon. So if we can kind of move this along, but I don't want to stop you, Dick, from saying the things you want to say. And one of the issues that I had, you know, we've made a tremendous commitment, capital improvements to the university, and I don't know the number. What is it, Don? $600-700 million, and we've got some more that we're doing. And I think that speaks to the commitment the legislature's made and how you transform that. And the next component of that, it gets back to the mission of the university and what we're doing. And I'd be interested in some more discussion about that, and particularly from the two board members as to their philosophy. I really like what you said about that you recognize and understand that you serve at the pleasure of the board, which to me means at the pleasure of the governor, which ultimately means at the pleasure of the citizens of Wyoming. And to me, that's a proper chain of command. I think maybe that hasn't been quite like that in the past. So maybe this would be a good opportunity if either one of the board members would like to make some comments. And, of course, one of the things that drove a lot of this discussion was the footnote in the budget bill. I think it was Senator Nicholas, Senator Schiffer, and myself that put that in there. And there was like 6 or 7 pointed questions. And I think it got to some of the frustrations we had. And, mm-hmm. and the Board of Trustees has responded to that. And so maybe we could have some discussion about that footnote and what you're doing, what the board is doing relative to the concerns we had. And the report, you know, I think it is kind of a shot across the bow, being an old Navy guy, if you understand my thinking. And we just wanted to, you know, instead of just being frustrated and talking to ourselves, and we thought we should just bring it to the head. And what that's a real good way of doing it is sticking in a budget bill and having a footnote. It got a lot of attention. So maybe we could, I don't want to get involved in your scheduling, but if there's an opportunity for the board to speak, would this be a good time?
Sure. And trustees, you would be welcome. Do you want to?
Sure.
Please identify yourself. Dave, we all know you, but for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you.
Are we on now?
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Bostrom. I am on the Board of Trustees of the university. I'm honored to serve as president of that board at this time. We've heard a lot of conversation about what goes on at the university, about the, as President McGinnity describes, the silos that exist between the levels of education in the state, and something that I think needs to be broken down. One of the things that is important, Mr. Chairman, and looking at the budget footnotes, is clearly they were, in a way, a shot across the bow. There were questions that need to be asked and questions that need to be answered. And they are being answered in due course. And I, for one, think it was it caused some thought to go on within the administration, within the Board of Trustees. And I think that the budget footnotes, in addition, the direction of the legislature in the Energy, Engineering, and STEM Task Force brought to play some thoughts within the university about whether we're doing the right things, are we going the right way, and how do we go about it. And that process brought together the legislature, because we had Senator Nicholas and Representative Lockhart that served on the EESI Task Force. I served on it. We had 5 very significant members of industry that served on that task force. And what it proved to me, and I think is what has now permeated the university, is that having that external review and having people that are giving the university advice, that the university needs to listen to that advice because they have some good ideas. After all, who are we serving? We are there to do basically 3 things. One is educate students for industry. if we don't know what industry or the employers, I shouldn't just say industry because it's other than industry, it's all employers, if we're not educating the students appropriately for them to go into those areas and to be contributing members the day they walk out the door, we're not doing our job. What better way to do it than to listen to the constituents? And by that I mean all constituents. And I think that's permeated the university. I think the reality of listening to that is there, and I think going forward we're going to see more and more of that over time. The second area is the area of research. We've got to do the research that is appropriate for the state of Wyoming to benefit the state of Wyoming. And the third is to provide people who go out and serve and do good work and make the world a much better place going forward. I think that in many cases we fail or have failed in the past, and where President McGinnity is leading us, is that we intend to do that. We intend to deal, Representative Harshman, with the issues you bring up of dealing with the various community colleges. We've heard it said many times that this is not the University at Laramie, this is the University of Wyoming. And I think that truly is part of the culture of the university now and how we get there. One of the things that concerns me, and we go back and talk about retention rates, and I was there when the Hathaway thing originally started, only I was on the other side of it. I was at the Business Alliance at that time. We're providing a lot of dollar of support and providing an opportunity for education, but I think that program has in some ways had some unintended consequences. We've established it on the basis of what your GPA is, your ACT coming in, and that establishes the various levels of the Hathaway. We had all hoped that it would drill down to the kitchen table about you've got to get better grades in order to get the best scholarships. Well, does that mean that they have studied the rigor that needs to be there? In some cases, it hasn't. What's happened is they've gone back to the kitchen table and said, maybe you shouldn't be taking the hardest courses because it may affect your GPA. So I think it's had a little bit of an unintended consequence that we may need to at a point in time deal with. The reality is, from Board of Trustees' standpoint, what's going on right now is fully endorsed and accepted by the Board of Trustees. It's things we've talked about over a number of years. We are at the point with leadership now where we are going forward with the personnel changes, the changes in direction, and that is only going to be enhanced by what's going on here today. Senator Bebout, I don't know if that responds to your question, but...
Well, thank you, Dave, and I think a lot of us, and I mentioned it earlier, appreciate the direction that the university is looking at, considering all of these different people and their input and what their perception of what a university should do in a place like Wyoming. So the thing that I just wanted to hear from your perspective, and I'm hearing it from both of you, is that there's been a change in direction. It's been driven by concerns, valid concerns, and discussion from a lot of people in our state, and you're responding to that, and we're not going to change direction because there's been a change at the president level, and that's one of the things that I was looking for. Committee members, do you have any questions of Dave at this particular time? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. President. I did mention this to the last two presidents as well, but for the last 10 years, I've had a daughter in college at one stage or another, so I've been around a lot of these kids. And two of those did attend the University of Wyoming. And one of the things I think we're really not doing a real good job of there is attracting that higher tier of students, maybe in the top 5% of the graduating class. Their friends are telling me they're leaving the state to go to other colleges, and they consider the University of Wyoming as a continuation of their high school. And I would hope that part of our mission statement going forward will be to try and attract more of these better students to the university.
Dave, would you care to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, couldn't agree with you more. We have to do a better job. Part of that has to do, and I think that President McGinnity can probably speak to it in more detail than I, but to be honest about it, we probably haven't done as good a job as we should in marketing the university. We are a business. Our business has a product. The product is the students that we produce that come out of there. How do you produce the best students? You recruit the best students. And I think in many ways we haven't done as good a job as we could in getting out and working with the high schools, with the counselors, with the superintendents, with the people in those areas to make certain that they fully understand. We do have an issue, and I can be blunt about it. You go to my part of the world, Worland, you go up on the northern tier, and there is I guess I'll call it a practice of some of the high schools, the counselors, they look north. They just do naturally, geographically, but the reality is, do they fully understand what's available in Laramie so that they can advise the students appropriately, or at least provide the information, if not the advice, to go that direction. So your point is very well taken and something the Board of Trustees takes seriously. We've had conversation about it. I know President McGinnity takes it very seriously. And it's something that that's one of those things we have to work on. And that is part of what I will call the culture shift that we're dealing with right now, is how do we go out and do that? Does it cost a little money to do it? Sure it does. But you don't create more students and better students without spending some of the money to do the marketing. So that's all part of the part and parcel of what we put together in how we present the university. And I hope that answers or helps answer part of the question.
Committee, any other questions?
Yes. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer.
I guess if I was looking at the University of Wyoming, you essentially have to be all things to all people. And as you begin to look at coordinating the different silos of between K through 12 community colleges and the university, that you do it from the perspective of the people that you serve and not your own self-interest. And I'll use a quote that I really like from Ronald Reagan, is that it was said that he instilled the courage of people to seek a future bright with the hope of economic and personal freedoms. And I think you have to look at those economic and personal freedoms of all the high school students that come out of our system and realize that sure, you can have the courage to go outside of the state, be more than you could be to use a military thing that is advertised, but realize too that your neighbors up there in Crowheart, that there's a lot of folks in Wyoming that they just want to get an education, they want to go home, they want to know what the rules are, and you got to have those consistent rules in education too. We don't have that consistency of rules in education in this state. We haven't had it for decades. And I hope that you can get to that. But when you do get to that, look at it from that perspective of economic and personal freedoms and realize that it's a tough thing for you guys to do, to be all things to all people in this state, but you're the only shop in town. And I think you understand that, but don't lose focus and make a silo that you think should be for the university, but get back to the focus of the kids out there that need that direction and need that opportunity, and let them make that decision. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, what I want to do, Dave, and you know, this is important. We have one university, we're all proud of it, and if we take a little bit longer, that so be it. I wanted to go through the footnote, and. And I think it's and I don't want to take a lot of time, but I just want to hear you and Dave, if you've got any comments that you want to make about them. I want to go just drill it down, you know, item by item real quick, like you can say what it's about in your response, and we'll try to do it within a short period of time. And then committee, if any of you have any questions about any of these issues, please feel free. But I think it's important because we didn't stick it in. It was a shot across the bow, but it's some good stuff, some good questions that needed to be asked, and we have your responses. Committee, you've all seen their responses, but I think it's important enough that you just take the time to go through it one by one. So do you have the copy? Do you have a copy of it, Dave?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not have that in front of me.
I'll give you mine, but it's got a lot of notes on it. Maybe you could just say what I say, and then it'll save a lot of time.
Everybody has it on SharePoint as well. And here's one here.
I was educated at the university, so I can read. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I guess we can go directly on down through the report and talk about each one very briefly, and perhaps I can just read them and then we can go through them. And
Dave, I mean, we've all seen it. We're all very aware of it. Just a quick highlight of which one you're, is just start with one.
Item number I. Report on current practices for installing permanent artwork on the campus and recommend a policy requiring trustee approval of artwork which is permanent and which becomes a fixture on university properties. There's been established, and Chris Boswell, if I misspeak, if you would assist me as we go through, there has been established, there's an art committee that consists of a broad spectrum on campus. They review for the value, the culture, where it's going to be, how it's going to look, what it's going to be for the long term. They make recommendations. Those recommendations go to the president of the university, who reviews and then discusses and coordinates with the president of the board of trustees. And the trustees have given their authority to the president of the board of trustees to review that and to either agree or disagree on the appropriateness of the artwork. So I think we responded in that way. We do have trustee involvement in that selection process, and I think that that's appropriate. It's not going to be limiting, because we're not going to try to limit any kind of academic freedoms that might exist through that, but it needs to be reviewed for the appropriateness for the campus.
Okay, questions? Okay, number two.
Number two, report on current practices of selecting deans of the university and colleges. Recommend a policy which incorporates a selection committee which uses non-university personnel trained in the college's disciplines and which eliminates the capacity of individual use of the university faculty to eliminate or veto candidates for the dean selection. I think I can say that in probably one word, done. There is not a process that allows any individual faculty member or any individual overall, except perhaps the president of the university, when a recommendation comes to him from a selection committee or from the provost's office that says we wish to appoint this person, the president is the one who makes that final decision and then recommends approval of the appointment to the board of trustees. But there is the involvement of all of those aspects that are requested in the footnote, and that is being done and has been done as requested. I think probably what drove part of the footnote was a concern that individual faculty members in various colleges could have the possibility of being the veto power. From my standpoint, that does not exist.
Well, and that's, I think that's, you nailed it right there. We understand the difficulty, and we talked about earlier, Dick, about being the president of a university versus the CEO. You know, clearly the deans work for the president, and clearly they work for the board. And, I mean, and you're going to have that involvement. We wanted to be sure that, and there's always going to be people that have differences of opinions. They're always going to have the right to say what they want to say. That's not going to change, but the chain of command issue is what I think we were really drilling down on. So any questions on that one, committee? And we'll be watching that one closely, too. That's one that's pretty important to us. Okay, number three.
And number three, report on the current practices of selecting and retaining staff assigned to the School of Energy Resources and recommend a policy which provides an approval and review process for the school staff by the Energy Resources Council.
And before I get into that, you know, this is personally, but one of the frustrations I had is the state of Wyoming, the legislature, and rightfully so, stepped up and set up the School of Energy Resources, and there was a reason we did it. And there was a direction we wanted it to go, and we wanted the involvement. And clearly you can see that by us taking it out of your budget. We could have said do it and now do it within your own budget. But we wanted you to understand the importance of it, and we broke it out separately so we would fund it separately. But I shared a lot of frustration and sensed it not only from the people involved in it, but personally where they didn't respond to the legislature. They responded more to, I hate to say it, but Old Main. I don't like that. I didn't like it. I like the way you're doing it. I don't want to go back there. That would be a big step backwards, in my opinion. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think you're going to find any disagreement. You've heard a lot of discussion this morning about the fact that there's been a cultural shift, and that is listening to the people that are important to the university, which includes the legislature, governor's office, and, in fact, the citizens of the state of Wyoming, the people that we serve. And I think this speaks to it, that it is extremely important that we listen over time and that we be responsible, we be accountable back to the legislature, the governor, and the citizens of the state of Wyoming.
And I think it's a win-win for everybody. It doesn't detract from the mission of the university. It's just a way for us to add and grow and utilize that talent. I mean, it's just, to me, it's a logical fit. Any questions on this one, committee? Okay. Number four,
report on the current practice of raising buildings constructed as part of the original campus prior to 1980 and recommend a policy which provides approval by the legislature before raising any historic buildings.
This is more or less Senator Nicholas's. I didn't realize that you were tearing things down that had a huge historical value. Please go ahead.
I think it probably best, and Chris, if you would respond to that particular one, it would probably be better.
Chris?
Mr. Chairman, not intending any disrespect, I'll do it seated. If you'd like me to stand, I don't know what's appropriate for the committee. But, Mr. Chairman, basically the concern I think that generated this initial portion of the footnote was a component of the university's future building plans included the raising of Merrica Hall. And there was some question of whether that was a particularly good idea, in part because the plan didn't suggest what was going to take its place. There was simply a note that it was going to be raised. I think what you'll see in the response from the university, Mr. Chairman, is very definitely a desire to involve the legislature before any of these historic buildings are raised, and to afford the legislature the opportunity to be involved both from a financial basis in terms of reviewing any of these plans before they move forward, but also very definitely a recognition of the opportunity for the legislature to have a voice before circumstances like that are carried out. There's also the beginning work on, and I may be jumping ahead on one of these points, but doing effectively a campus-wide, but in particular for the historic area in the neighborhood of Prexy's Pasture and in the blocks around there, of identifying historic buildings, make sure we have identified those which are historic, and do everything we can to maintain and respect the historic nature of many of the buildings on campus. Also, I think, again, probably jumping ahead on one of these points, I think there is a very definitely renewed interest on the part of the administration and the Board of Trustees to respect the characteristics and the physical external characteristics of the buildings on campus, that perhaps the university had strayed from that to some degree. Perhaps that was because of cost and building cost to make a building look really terrific on the outside as well as the inside. There's probably a cost associated with that. So there may have been a reason for that. But through the efforts of a number of legislators, I think the university and the Board of Trustees has been reminded how very important the appearance of the University of Wyoming is, and the historic nature of the appearance of the University of Wyoming. And the trustees, in their response to you, I think recognize that and very definitely plan on pursuing that far more aggressively than has happened in recent years.
Mr. Co-Chair, you got a question, Chris?
Chris, just real quick then, and part of that footnote, you know, is recommend a policy that required legislative approval. So as I read the response, and how has that policy changed then? Is
it, Chris?
I don't see. I mean, you say we're going to involve the legislature, but.
Mr. Chairman, as we go forward, one thing that that I think we're mindful of is this is a report to the legislature. The legislature, through the course of this session, may say, no, we want something done very specifically. So in certain areas where we're able to do to move forward on some of these recommendations before the legislature has a chance to react to this report, we're moving forward on it. But on others, we have been cautious not to roll forward with these recommendations before we've heard back from you. if you're not satisfied with what some of these points might be, the last thing we should be doing is running around instituting changes to policy before you've had a chance to feedback.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Number five, and this one of these, the reasons that brought this up on the architectural features is Senator Nicholas and I think President Ross and I were having a meeting one night late at the Capitol talking about the, what was it, Tony, the engineering building, I believe, and Phil, and we had our, from the ANI, from the Construction Management Division, there's a sharp lady over there that's an architect, and they just weren't listening to anything that we wanted to even talk about. It's like, this is the way it is. We don't care how you want it. You just give us the money. We're going to do it our way. And, you know, I didn't like that. None of us did. So that's the purpose for this. So please respond.
I think many of the things that, Mr. Chairman, I think many of the things that Vice President Boswell spoke to come into this one also. We're dealing with treating the architectural features that maintain the history of the University of Wyoming are extremely important. Having the public input, having input from the legislature, making certain that we are maintaining that historical aspect that is so important to all of us is a focus of the Board of Trustees, and it's something that we have asked to happen and will, as Chris indicated, as there are responses, if there's further work that needs to be done. But I don't think there's any disagreement when you come through the Board of Trustees that doing that, even though we know it costs a little bit more money to do some of those things and using a lot of the native sandstone and other aspects of the historical view, they're important. They're important to the citizens. They're important to the culture of the university. So we fully intend to go forward.
And we have a long-range development plan, and what I'm hoping will be happening is that plan, and it's there and in place, that we'll be visiting with our people and work together on this. I mean, I don't think it's the kind of thing we need in statute to say, but it's the kind of thing that we could certainly move forward on. The next one is, President Ross, if you'd like to speak to this one, too, because you've been really involved in it. It deals with the matching funds and the UW Foundation and some concerns we have. Would you care to address that issue at all, Tony, or just it's, you know, dealing with the foundation? And
sure. And I'll just report to the committee that we've been working hard with the foundation and have hosted a meeting in Casper when JAC was present in Casper, foundation members, working through the whole idea of how do we as legislators understand what's going on and what's the relationship between the foundation and the Board of Trustees, and how is our money that we appropriate, how is that fully tracked? Focused. I think though you'll see a couple of bills that'll be out of a judiciary committee that will address most of our concerns. But I think a lot of what we did as a result of this footnote was educational more than anything, in terms of learning us ourselves as legislators how things are actually done, and making sure that we will have that information in the future so that we can track and know how our money's being spent and where it's being spent.
Yeah, and Tony, thank you very much for that. And one of the concerns I think that I heard certainly from a lot of people, and the university and the foundation does a great job of raising money, no question about it, we need to do that. But there's one component that really kicked it off, and what was that? Matching grants. And we were glad to be able to do that, we being the legislature, and thank goodness for the minerals industry to be able to be facilitate and support that. But I think there were some concerns about, I don't know how many millions of dollars, it's been $80, $90, $100 million, that might go in directions that maybe a lot of the legislature, maybe the majority, did not see it going that way. Now, the people that give their personal gifts, that's their right. We are concerned about how the money was utilized and tracking it and constitutional issues. So, Dave, you've seen the two bills, the judiciary, and, you know, we worked together on this. I think Tony, we're on the right track, and we're moving forward together. Would you agree? Or,
Mr. Chairman, I absolutely would agree. The bills that are going to be presented give some definition. I think part of the issue, quite honestly, was perhaps not specific enough reporting to the people who wanted to see it about where those funds resided, how they were accounted for, how the proceeds from the endowments were being used, were they being used for the appropriate purpose. And I think that that reporting functionality has been, if you will, corrected. It was always there, but I don't think it was probably presented in a way that was fully understandable. And what I would say to any member of the committee or the legislature or the appropriate committees is if there is information from the foundation that is needed or wanted, pick up the phone and let the foundation know. We can generate, the foundation can generate, any kind of accountability report, application report, distribution report, whatever it may be, so that there is a complete understanding and degree of comfort with the fact that the funds are being used, are being spent the way they were intended by the donor and by the state as the matching as the matcher of those funds. And it is being done, but it's a matter that I don't think people had the information and were comfortable. It's kind of show me that it is being done. I think that's been done, and we're very comfortable going forward as President Ross indicated.
You know, and it's something we can all be so very proud of. And I look back at when President Dubois came to the university, and I don't know how much money we had in the foundation program, but it was not very much. And he really, and I still take my hat off to Phil for the hard work, working with the legislature he did to get that kick started and raise this money, and then how the legislature stepped up to with the matching. And actually, it's $185 million, I think, is the amount of money that we put into there. One of the concerns I think we had, Tony, was underwater. And this is just maybe my personal philosophy. I don't know how the committee feels about this, but you know, personally, when I give some money to the university or whatever, I don't expect the corpus to ever be violated. And I know you have policies about it gets down to, what, 20 or 25% before you start kicking it off. And I'd be interested in your philosophy and maybe even yours, Dick, about that issue.
Mr. Chairman, the legislature, was it 2 years ago when we approved the use of UPMIFA? And I'm speaking a little bit out of my realm because I'm not on the foundation board and I am not a true expert in it. But it does, under UPMIFA, it allows an even distribution of money, even though at times during severe economic problems, you may be able in certain cases to use some of the corpus to maintain a consistency of funding to the programs that they were intended with the full intent then of building it back up. The state has said, don't want you to do that. Okay, not going to do it. And I think that may be an oversimplification, but that's the reality of what's going to happen. With private donors, that's all part of the endowment agreement that they enter into at the time that occurs. All of those are being visited as we go forward, making certain that we're able to manage the funds appropriately, use them for the intention or the proceeds from the endowed funds for the intention that the donor, both private and state, intended it to be used for to help programmatically, but not to violate the wishes of donors. And if you look at the who's the largest donor, if you will, from that standpoint, it's the state of Wyoming. And using that money appropriately in the way it is wanted to be used by the state of Wyoming is what the foundation must and should do, period.
Co-chair, did you have any comments? This is a pretty big issue. Do you have any?
You know, I think that's it. I addressed the concerns, so we appreciate it.
Oh, Senator Perkins.
I did have one question for you, and I'm still trying to figure out how I feel about this. There was recently I was attending the State Treasurer's Investment Seminar, and on there I think I learned that, I can't remember if it was from Senator Nicholas or the State Treasurer, that recently a donor, one of the donors that was used for a matching grant was the gift of a future interest, meaning that I think that there was a promise to give by a particular donor in the future a certain amount in the future, and ultimately, even though the donation hadn't been received by the university yet because it was to happen in the future, it was counted as a match to go forward in the construction of or the use of the matching funds provided the legislature. And I thought about that, and it just kind of caught me off guard. I had never, even though I probably should have, because I practice and I do some work in the areas of future interest. But nevertheless, it kind of caught me off guard, and I'm just wondering how widespread that is, and I'm trying to figure out how I feel about that yet. And so if you've got some comments about how often that's used and the benefits and the detriments that brings to the university, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, Dave, I don't know if you feel comfortable. Go ahead if you can answer that.
Mr. Chairman, my response is simply I don't think I'm qualified, Senator Perkins, to answer the question. I know from conversations with the foundation staff and with very significant board members that deal in this kind of thing over a period of time that they're getting more and more into those kinds of bequest-type issues. That someone makes a donation, and you don't know for sure what ultimately it's going to be. It's banked on, it's valued, but you don't have any real way of doing it. From the standpoint of matching, I'm not qualified to answer the question, and I don't know if we, Dick, if you have a response to that.
Dick, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins. I am not expert in that area, and I respect highly attorneys who are. But I will say this: as at least a former to some degree still practicing finance person, because that's what I was. Anything about the handling or the management of money of funds, cash, that is not clear and unambiguous, gives me hives. Or a rash or something. I mean, it just makes me really, really nervous. So that's one observation. Second is I appreciate that the foundation in some respects is a semi-independent entity from the university. The head of it is still a vice president of the university. And so anything, well, that's the second point. Third point, my alma mater got caught up in a nasty, nasty litigation over over $100 million, if my memory is right, with the heirs of a former donor who asserted that the funds were not used for the purposes intended. Now, why an agreement between the university and a donor would not be clear about that, I have no idea. I never read any of the documentation. But it ended up in a settlement with significant amounts of funding being returned to the heirs.
You know what we need to do maybe on that one, Senator Perkins, is get a response from the foundation board. And just let me finish, Rick, and then you can. And in fact, Mr. Chairman, you know, there's some other issues. We might even think about when we do our callback, maybe having Ben Blaylock come over and participate if we ask specific questions. Rick, did you have an answer or a response?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Rick Miller, Vice President, General Counsel. Senator Perkins. One of two things. One approach might be that when a commitment is made, funds aren't transferred, but they are, if you will, obligated within the state treasurer's office, so we don't double up, if you will, on funds that could be matched. That's one issue. The second issue is it is possible, as you obviously well know, to give some kind of an interest in property or some other gift where the future interest, like you retain a life estate, but you actually make a gift that can be valued, a dollar amount, and I thought you were headed with endowments, but if it's for a cash expendable gift, that gives me pause too. So I guess what I would say is, I know the issue. Let me help Ben, Vice President Blaylock, get information in anticipation of any callback and any other questions. We can get you the specific answers. I don't know how widespread it is, but I can think of maybe one case where something like that happened. But we need to respond to your question, Mr.
Senator Chairman. Perkins, that work for you?
Right. Yeah, that, Mr. Chairman. And I mean, ultimately what you have is, I mean, there are great tax advantages in estate planning things to provide significant charitable gifts at death. Sometimes they're just outright gifts. Sometimes, and probably where we're talking about is maybe a setup of a charitable lead trust or a charitable remainder interest trust that at the end of the trust, the whatever's left in the principal goes to the university. And those are great devices, and obviously we want to encourage those types of legacy and inheritance types of gifts. I was struggling with the fact that, and it could be wrong, because you know nothing's worse than second and third hand information. So I'm reserving judgment, but my understanding was that that type of gift was then the present value of that gift was used as a matching grant. If all we're doing is reserving and counting it against a match that's on held until it's received in the treasurer's office, that's one thing. But if it's in my mind, if Mr. Chairman, if what happens is the state comes up with its money now, and there's a gift that happens based on someone's life expectancy, which might be another 10 or 15 or 20 years into the future, and that's what that counts as a current matching gift now, that seems to give me some pause. And like I said, I'm still trying to figure out what I think about that.
Mr. Chairman, we'll answer the question.
Thanks, Rick. Any other questions, committee? The one thing I think so important for us in this particular area is it's really working well, and we want to have a message to go out to the people that want to give, that we're together on this. And there's some, you know, and I heard early on that some concerns from not only the people that donate from the university about, well, what are you doing meddling in our business? Well, it is our business, and it'll continue to be our business, and I want you to be sure and understand that. And I think it's all for the better, because we need to be together as we move forward. If you have people out there considering large gifts, you want them to understand and realize how the legislature and the states are committed to this. So I think this has all been really positive. This is one of the best things I think that's happened from this footnote, is to get this back on track.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more. The matching program has been transformational for the University of Wyoming. It has brought significant private money that wouldn't have come had that not happened. We want to make certain that it's done properly. We believe it has significant value going forward in the long term, and as things come up that need to be addressed on how the program is managed or operated, we need to have the openness of communication to be able to address those things, and not just address them when a problem occurs, but to address them when a question comes up of how are we going to handle it, how do we go forward. And I think that's what we have in place now, are the people in the leadership to see that that happens. And I would encourage, anytime there are questions, that let's talk about them immediately and begin to develop solutions to what the questions might be.
Well, we've brought it to everyone's attention, and as we go forward, we'll certainly be watching it. Senator Meyer.
And I think to add on, and Rick, I think this is for you and the foundation, is maybe some discussion on in-kind gifts, and we'll go into the details of that at a later date. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, last one, number 7, Dave. Endowed chairs.
Mr. Chairman, providing a report to the legislature on endowed chairs and how they're being allocated and where they're being used, absolutely available, and we will go forward with it, period.
This is one of the areas where I think the underwater issue came up, because mm-hmm. you have an endowed chair and there's a certain amount of money that's set aside, and you have a hiccup in the markets or whatever, and you go below that, and that was one of the concerns. You know, not so much for the private side, I mean, that's up to them, but from the state dollars. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a legitimate concern that the state has about that corpus. And, you know, it's, you can argue constitutionally that that corpus should be maintained, and so I think we've really made some progress there. Any other comments or questions, committee, about the footnote? Dick.
Chairman, I would observe that I have observed that the not only is the management of the dollars important, but also the reporting of the benefits of the endowment, and not just in terms of spending of money, but what were the results? What were the benefits? The reporting on that sort of thing, I would say, across the university is variable, and it needs not to be. There are going to be more, if this management team does its job well, there are going to be more endowed chairs and more donors with who's got specific donor intent. We have to be aware of that, and we need a systematic way of assuring that donor intent is being achieved, and we intend to do that.
Okay. Anything else? The members of the committee, you got any footnotes prepared for this next budget cycle? I see a lot of grins, but no. Okay, we've kind of got involved in your schedule there, Dick, but I'm glad we did this. Dave, thank you very much, and
you,
appreciate you responding to some of these questions. Please continue with your presentation, and it's I show that it's now 8:30. but these are important things, so continue. And, yeah. And anybody that you want to have visit, we're just going to take the time to do it. And we will get through this, and we'll do it in as quickly as we can.
I intend to facilitate as best I can. We dug into some details after I began summarizing for you what my and the management team's near-term priorities are. So let me just finish summarizing those. There may be some questions about it, but we can get into the numbers here pretty quickly. We were talking about improving student recruitment, retention, graduation rates, and so on. That's point one. Point two, the university has had a long-term planning process in the past. It has been conceptual. It has not been what one might call a business plan. It has identified aspirational goals, many of them in a variety of areas. There's been no timeline or resource allocations or benefits projected for these things other than that they were good to do. We're in the planning process now for the fourth one of these planning exercises. It's going to span the next three biennia. This plan will be something much more like a strategic plan than what the university has produced before. Were you leading to a question by any chance?
Well, what I was going to say is that, you know, a lot of the commitments the legislature has made in the previous three or four years has been sort of a little bit on blind faith. But, you know, as dollars get tougher and we're going into some cycles where we're not going to have the money we've had in the past, it's only fair for the legislature to demand that we have a good, long, strategic plan so we can see the benefits of the money that, you know, it's just not like there's a pot of money out there and we can just spend it everywhere. It's going to be a lot of priorities, and how we allocate those funds is a big job for this committee and as we move forward. And so I think that's very, very important. And if we're going to commit to any kind of additional funding for the university as we move forward, we'd like to know that there's a good plan of where we go. So,
Mr. Chairman, just like any wise investor would think about it. Continuing, the plan will be programmatic, operational, and resource allocations. And just to summarize, they will be focused on six areas of academic distinction. We've already talked about how undergraduate education is the key. But these are, in no particular order, professions critical to the state and the region. And this is both teaching and research related to these things. Critical areas of science and technology, such as computational science and engineering, earth and energy science and engineering, water resources. The third is cultural assets, arts and humanities. This goes to the preservation aspect that you were mentioning a few minutes ago. And environment and natural resources. History and culture of the Rocky Mountains, and finally life sciences, including biomedical, ecology, molecular and cellular life science, and neuroscience. The research in these areas and teaching in them, education in them, are directly focused on the governor's task force, the Tier 1 agenda, not just in energy and engineering, but in other areas too, because that was the governor's mandate. And then and there'll be resource allocations around these themes, if I may say so. So there's going to be more, and you're right to expect a more detailed plan from the university than you've received in the past.
One of the things I don't hear you mention is the research component. And I can remember years ago when we were so broke, we didn't have any money, and Bill Guerin and I were running around, mostly Bill, trying to raise a couple million. In fact, it was a big press release when we raised $1 million for some kind of research, and now we're up to, I don't know, Bill, we're $100 million. I mean, we've done some really exciting things, or that's got to be a part of that, too.
Well, I think I said, if I didn't, I'll make it clear. This has to do with involves research in these areas, and as well as education of undergraduates and graduate students and PhDs.
Okay.
What
we're going to do is it's a 9:45. I think the next thing, do you have anything else you want to comment on as the overview from the president's position, because I want to start getting into the budget?
Yeah. Three more quick things.
Please continue.
We need to develop management and leadership abilities within UW's management team. I would observe that the training and experience of career academics is, in some respects, insufficient for purposes of managing an organization of the size and complexity of a university of this size. and we have to work on developing the management skills of our administrators, not just at the vice president level, but at the deans and directors level. The fourth is communicate more actively, effectively with the legislature and other external constituencies of the university. And finally,
how do you anticipate doing that?
Well, it starts today with meetings like this. And we will do as much of it as you wish. But
be careful what you wish for.
I will manage it. That's our job. Our purpose is to not have you and the legislature feel as though you're in the dark. Our purpose is to enable you to understand clearly where the university is seeking to go and why and what the benefits are of doing it that way. And so we can have a conversation about it as we go along. It's kind of like what a management of a business does with its board of directors, or should do, at least, anyway. And finally, develop a financial plan for funding the pursuit of these long-term goals that I talked about. So we need the university for its own planning, for its own management, needs a plan for where it seeks to go in over the next 6 years and how resources are going to be allocated to do that.
And that's so on point, because it's easy to come to the Joint Appropriations Committee, and generally people come here and it's not it's about money. We understand that. But when it ties together, for there's a real purpose other than, well, we just want to raise salaries because we haven't for 3 or 4 years. There's a real need, a real design, and I think that what this committee is interested in is you know, that's a valid point. There haven't been raises for a while, but where does it take us, and what is the validity of it, and what are we really trying to achieve, and where do we want to go, and where do we want to be? And if you don't have a plan, if you're not thinking about and talking about that, it's just, you're here, and you know, we're here, and we do the budget session, we do what we do, and everybody goes on. That's not what I'm looking for. So is there more that you'd like to talk about before we get into the budget, Dick?
That's it.
Okay. Members of the committee, any questions of our president before
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you. Before we leave this, President, the long-term strategic plan starts when, ends when, and when can we have that report?
That'll cover the period, the fiscal year is 2000, or the academic year is 2015 through 2020.
Senator Meyer.
I'm curious why you had water resources in there. I'm on select water. We work, you know, with the university in that area. Relatively small budget from what we have with the research. The research a lot of times doesn't meet the goals that a lot of the folks on select water committee want to look at. I think it's a lot of conflict between the way those goals are developed and the research projects are developed. We're working on some new methodology. There's some conflicts with the legal department, with ex-professors from the law, water treatises that are problematic with the development of our water resources. There's a lot going on that really isn't, not conducive to the development of Wyoming's water resources. And so from the university's aspect, could you flesh out the water resource goal a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I would summarize what you're saying, I believe, by a lack of communication back and forth between Select Water and the research efforts that are going on with water resources. I think that's what you're getting at. If I'm incorrect in that, Senator, please correct me. Having said that, I think Vice President Gurn is here, who is in a position to talk about what is going on in water resources, if the chairman will allow further
Senator
detail
Meyer,
on this.
That response, or?
I guess I would say is that we're working toward a different methodology to increase that communication as to what Select Water expects, and so I think we're making steps to move that way. Water is a situation that's near and dear to my heart and to the area that the folks that I represent, and so there's some challenges that we have,
And I think there's probably going to be some disagreement and some conflict and those things probably. When you talk about water, there's always a little bit of conflict someplace or another. So I'd certainly, Mr. Chairman, like to have the opportunity I think we're running short on time today, so I think we're going to have to do this either out in the hall or something else, and I'll get back to the committee and maybe we could get a one page or something about what we're looking at.
Yeah, and understand, of course, that there may be an opportunity for callbacks if we have some further discussion we want to do.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say I grow a modest amount of hay in Crowheart, so I understand how precious water is to the agricultural interests in the state. And obviously it's a precious resource and jeopardized in who knows what number of ways. So the state must get this right, and that is our purpose to assist in that.
Okay. Representative Moniz, you know, you're the House member that's responsible for the University of Wyoming's budget. Do you have any questions over there?
I don't at the present time, Mr. Chairman. Once we get into the budget, I think I'll have quite a
okay,
few.
Well, with that lead, what we're going to do, we're going to take about a five-minute break, stretch our legs, and Bill will get into the budget, and I'm sure there's a lot of discussion that will come from that. So thanks, Dick, for the overview. We really appreciate it. Welcome aboard.
Chairman.
We're glad you're there.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, let's get started. For the members of the committee, you got your little get paid sheet on your desk, and I sent an email out to you, too, about the procedurally how we get paid. So if you want to get paid, fill them out before noon. If you don't want to get paid, we can donate it to the University of Wyoming. Everybody smiled when I said that.
Is that a gift of the future?
What I'd like to do is the way we proceed, and Bill is such a veteran at this, is, and Mr. Co-Chair, I think we kind of going to work through the budget. We just start with page one and just assume that we know nothing, and we're going to go through it like that. Bill, you got a comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we gave you a handout that looks something like this in anticipation that maybe you might have a lot of questions for Dick early on in this thing. And I think if you want to work through this, I can work you through this pretty fast through the 067 budget. And the thing that's better about, I think, about this than what we have in our budget document, page 14 and 15, that lays out the exception budgets, is we've got a kind of our, you know, one of the keystone pieces of this budget is the engineering component.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's don't spend a lot of time. We'll go through this quickly, but I still want to go through the budget.
Okay.
Page by page and line by line, standard budget, et cetera. And Dick, I was on the JAC when we didn't have a block grant. And we spent a week in the university and over there going and counting, I hate to say it, but counting paper clips. I like the block grant a lot better. So let's do that. Let's go through. Everybody have report 38? Is that what you're working off of, Bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Let's go through that quickly. Then we will go through the budget. Page by page. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one comment.
Sure.
I'd just like to observe in general that the document that you're looking at is intended to support specifically the priorities that we've talked about earlier on this morning.
Okay. All right, Bill.
Yep. Mr. Chairman,
just a second. Senator Perkins.
Don, is this up at all anywhere? Do we have that? Okay. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Are we ready, committee? Okay, Bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. On page one of that document, priority 1A and 1B, those are the compensation requests that were made clear back in July of the governor's office, broken out by the university proper and then also SER separately, School of Energy Resources separately. Those represented, I believe, a 4% biennial increase at that point. So those numbers that you see there, and the reason why I have the asterisks in the governor's recs column is he pulled all of that money out, and you'll see that as you can look on pages 14, 15 in that summary or this summary, or we can work through it in the budget. But basically pulled out everybody's compensation and made an overall uniform compensation request. And I think you guys have been through that so much at this point, you probably don't need further explanation from us. University obviously supports that approach. The next, I think, important item on that page under compensation is the insurance component, and the budget office and the governor's office adopted the budget office rec on this. On page 18 of your budget, you'll find, I have referenced we have referenced the page numbers of the budget document proper in this summary. But page 18, I think you'll see that $53.4 million that the budget office is recommending, pulling that out of the block grant, treating that insurance component similarly to the way the community colleges deal with insurance. We support that notion.
Committee, if you have any questions while we're going through it, pop up. Okay.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, the next big chunk of this thing is related to engineering, and there are a number of recs in there. I tried to get them in page number order and had to pull in a chunk of CapCon to kind of get you to the overall look at this thing, because that engineering plan is a pretty big one, pretty comprehensive one, and quite frankly, pretty impressive one, I would say. We have an extremely good spokesman here for it, if you want to talk to him, if you want to take the time to do that. And Khalid's sitting in the back row, I believe, and engineering this engineering transformation, and pretty interesting. And actually, I think it's unfortunate that Senator Meyer isn't sitting in the chair, because I think Khalid has a vision, and probably others at the university right now have a vision to apply a similar kind of approach anyway to other programs, and I think water is one of the ones that's been mentioned. But getting back to the engineering piece of this, there's a piece on page 35 and 36 that deals with the programmatic implementation and the request, and you guys, you also have a summary from Khalid about the implementation of this program. That's the $8 million request. The engineering school has reprioritized some monies within. The university has done some further reprioritization to get to those numbers that you see on that engineering summary.
Committee, do you want to ask questions and we get to this in the budget, or do you want to do it now? Okay, keep going.
Okay. So there's that programmatic component. There is also the equipment component on page 36 for the high bay facility. And there's some reprioritization of AML monies that have been already appropriated. And I think there was I hope I'm not over-speaking on this, but I think there was a little bit of perhaps a misunderstanding where that AML money was at exactly, and I think there's further work to be done on that, and we want to vet it with Governor's office as well. We appreciate what he's doing for us, and it was our request, and now I'm not sure that we like our request on that $3 million part.
Well, wait a minute. You requested something that you really wanted, and now you're not sure you like it. I'll remember. That's one.
Boswell's going to take me out and whoop on me now, Mr. Chairman. It was a nice thing. Hey, I made it almost as long as one of the presidents.
Getting brutal.
Boswell tells me he's on his third, Mr. Chairman. No offense, Dick. So, moving on, there's $7.5 million of general fund money associated with that high bay building. That's a high priority for us, as is the rest of this engineering piece. There's a $5 million general fund appropriation recommendation from the governor. I don't think the university actually went forward with this in the original document, but you'll see the $5 million show up as a governor's rec. That's matching money for an endowed chair in petroleum engineering. And then the last piece is that CapCon piece, which will also show up on page 2 of that summary. And that's taking $7.9 million of the money that's already been appropriated in prior sessions and continuing on with the Level 2 and Level 3 planning process for that engineering building. Ready to move on?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to the other operating piece. The first one you'll see is it shows as page 40. It was priority 2 under a couple of administrations ago. $20 million for matching funds for Superior Faculty Endowment, which Superior Faculty is also a central theme in the university, I think. But we agree with the governor's rec on that piece. The next piece has to do with UW's information technology request. There was $2.867 million requested for wireless backbone-type expenditures to bring, I believe, and Vice President Aylward is also sitting in the gallery back here, to bring that, I believe, a 2007 system up to current snuff and to keep the thing working correctly. Governor?
Is that Mr. Coach? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, is that, just to refresh my memory, is that the WiMAX kind of wireless?
Mr. Chairman, it's not. It's a different piece. They have different functions and different accessibility. I'm sure that Bob would love to talk to you if you have a moment.
Well, it's up to the good chairman. Maybe when we get to that point in the budget, we'll just finish this overview.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, the next piece is the BSL-3 operations, maintenance, and regulatory compliance request. That was for $1.33 million. Governor recommended it at $665,900, half of the amount. There was a question when I was here on Monday, I believe, from Representative Moniz as to whether or not this was for the repairs on that facility, and it is not. What that represents, Representative Moniz, is that whole 1-3 is the biennium's worth of operations and getting that thing certified and up and running. We did a little bit of checking in the meantime, really pushing those contractors to give us a ballparker on the repair costs of that. And this is not to say that it's a request. We're still trying to figure out exactly who's responsible, what the avenues are on this. But it looks like it is going to be about $1.25 million to fix that thing from that brownout problem.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, really quickly. So what is the plan, Bill, there with that then? Are you waiting for solid numbers? Are you going to put that off another year? What's the plan?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think there's any intent to put it off any longer than we have to. I will tell you the primary consultant on that project had some health issues. Some of my staff is pushing pretty hard on that contractor to get this moving along and get this thing fixed and up and running.
So are you going to ask for funds to fix it, or do you have the funds internally to fix it?
Mr. Bill? Chairman, it's a complicated question, Representative. I think ideally, in the state, Construction Management Division handled that project for us. So it's a little weird in that regard, too. From a normal UW project, but I think, and I certainly don't want Rick to team up with Chris when they take me out back here, but I think you run into possibly some legal issues as far as whether or not we can recover some money and all of that. But bottom line is we'd like to see that thing up and running, obviously.
Okay, continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the next one down is the off-campus facilities operations and maintenance component. And I believe that's in three places. It's the Riverton Intertribal Center, Sheridan Extension, and the Casper Joint UW facility, Casper College Joint UW facility. And the governor recommended that operations and maintenance money. He denied our request for $500,000 for operations and maintenance for on-campus facilities. The next one down is Wyoming Public Media. That's an infrastructure component. Basically, I believe, and there are people here who can speak to this in far more detail than me, that is replacement of some transmitters, some aging transmitters, tube-type generation of electronics. And I think the majority of what they're seeking to replace is actually beyond its expected lifespan at this point. Pardon me. Governor, Mr. Chairman, the governor recommended half of the requested amount, and that it doesn't fit exactly with doing half the project, but we'll make things work out with that number. The next one down is the Strategic Community College Partnerships component, and I believe that has to do with a Bachelor of Science degree in Casper in Clinical Lab Sciences. Governor recommended funding for that, $726,880, and there's some personnel associated with that as well to make that program operational up there for a bachelor's degree. Next one down is an additional request for $200,000 for brucellosis research funding. Governor adopted that. The next one down actually probably belongs in capital construction, but the governor's rec shows up in the operating budget. It's the final $5 million required for the AA.
You said the final
$5 million. Presumably, Mr. Chairman. We have a guy here who can talk to you about that, too.
I will. I see Tom. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, turning the page to page two, the CapCon, that first CapCon project was covered in the engineering summary. That's the level two and level three prior appropriations money. Second one on the list is part of the long-range development plan. It's two parts of the long-range development plan, actually, and the governor chose to fund one part of it, which is two water wells for irrigation purposes on campus. The part that was denied is the King Street renovation addressment. That's back behind. King Street is the alleyway back behind the dorms. And there are some concerns, questions, whatever, about pedestrian safety and all of that. You guys have walked through there. And
pretty attractive, too, Mr. Chairman.
That's the goal, is to help make it a little more so, Mr. Chairman. part of the goal. Also not to be sued for killing somebody, I think. The next one down, the next CapCon piece down is classroom adaptation. I'll speak a little out of school here since I'm already a dead man anyway. Level three, I actually had a meeting with a bunch of my people yesterday that have to do with facilities and maintenance, and asked them, well, what's the difference between the $4 million and the $8 million? Is that killing us? Or are we going to live? What really is the bottom line? And I think those guys on the ground in those buildings are the best guys to get those answers from, rather than the guys in Old Main, is my experience thus far. It was pretty interesting because a very respected facilities guy there said, frankly, $4 million is the right number. $8 million would have been hard to get out the door in time. And as soon as he was done talking, the next person that spoke was in charge of the classroom building and said, we have all these connectivity issues in classroom building, and we've got to get that updated, or within 2 years we won't be able to connect to all these various networks, apparently, that building connects to via the telecommunications setup there. The guy that I spoke to prior retracted. He said, we're going to need the 4 plus the 8 probably, and it'll all go out the door fast. So that's kind of the nature of that university campus that I'm finding, is that you got a mixture of ages of buildings, and some of it's expensive and some of it, they're just on the right schedule for. It doesn't take much to throw a wrench in the works when you have that kind of an issue coming up, though. So we can live with the $4 million, but understand you'll probably hear some squawking fairly soon about the classroom building again, which is probably news to Dick, too. The the next one is Cirrus Sky on page 73 of the budget book. There was a level two amount requested for planning on that. That was denied by the governor, $350,000. Pardon me one second. Do you guys put a filter in that coffee on the right side?
I got to remind you, there's the Kurt Meyer, Senator Meyer coffee, that this is, you drink, it's kind of like tar, but it gets you going about 6 in the morning.
That's why I asked,
then
Mr.
you shift to the stuff over here.
It actually works out pretty good, because after the first part of this morning, I kind of wasn't really on the edge of my game here, but I feel like I'm getting there now. Mr. Chairman, the next piece is the CapCon piece on page 78, Community College Partnership Facility on campus, LCCC, Albany County campus, level two planning. That was denied. Those level two planning monies were denied. And then the last piece is the Corbett Pool planning piece. Thank you very much.
Hey, can we have a little cream, too, if you'd like some of that?
I'll quit my whining now.
Okay.
Corbett Pool level two planning money was denied also. And that's the CapCon component of it.
Okay. Do you have any comments to make about this general thing, Dick, at all?
excuse me. This is... I appreciate Bill's doing what he's done. My intention was to walk you through this myself, but this is much more efficient. And with respect, I would say one thing about the classroom building and the technology there. I taught in that building for 2 or 3 semesters, and the concept of it was great given the technology in the building, but it took almost a third of the semester before in the particular classroom I was using. It took them almost a third of the semester just to get it operating correctly so it was usable. And it's not rocket science stuff, but it's, you know, it's just age and connectivity, as Bill talks about.
Okay. Okay. We are ready to proceed to the budget. Is that where we are, committee?
So.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. What, if you don't mind my asking, what's been the procedure? What would you like to
see? We're going
to
go through it, starting with page one. Just flip through it. And things that you want to talk about on the pages, we'll talk about. If we have questions, committee, that's where we'll ask them. And I think that's what we want to do. I know that's what we want to do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think an awful lot of the meat of this budget was discussed or modified with a lot of the comments that Dick already made this morning. I think you know, a lot of the verbiage that's in here has to do with what the mission of the university is and what the direction, the desired direction is. I guess I would skip past a bunch of these unless you want to go there, Dave.
Tell us what the total amount of money that it takes to run the university for a 2-year period.
Mr. Chairman, that's a pretty good question. I'm a ballparker. I would say it's roughly... I think you're looking at something close to the Department of Health when you include all of Section 1 and all of Section 2. I think you're looking at close to $1 billion for biennium between the two sections.
Mr. Chairman, point of fact, being as a finance person, I pay attention to the audited financial statements of the university, and the revenue in the most recently ended fiscal year was, my recollection is, $555 million. That's revenue from all possible anything that any cash coming into the university from any source is that amount of money. So on a biennial basis, as Bill said, it's $1 billion plus.
Billion for the biennium.
Right, the biennium. Mr. Chairman. That's going to include research dollars. It's going to include tuition dollars. That, you know, every dollar that university brings in, that's included in that $1 billion.
So roughly $35,000 to $40,000 per student is about where we are. Okay. All right.
It's big operations.
Mr. Chairman, how has that changed? I mean, just for the committee, our grant and aid, our block grant in the last 10 years.
Mr. Chairman, ten years, I would say, block grant, I think the proportions are probably roughly the same over time. I think they've, would you say that's a fair assessment, Orly? Proportionally, it's grown roughly the same, block grant versus other.
I'm not sure about proportionally.
Please identify yourself and grab a mic.
My name is Arlie Williams. I'm Assistant Vice
President. We can't hear you. Just speak into that, please.
Yes, sir.
Or grab a mic.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Arlie Williams. I'm Assistant Vice President for Budget and Institutional Analysis. The Section 1 budget over the last 5 years, the state appropriation, the block grant appropriation in the budget bill, has shown some declines over the last 5 years. The net effects of those were, one, budget reductions in FY10 and budget reductions in FY14. The counterbalance to that was some state funding in the standard budgets for employee benefit adjustment costs, over the years, as well as some funding for specific initiatives such as libraries. So those were the trends within Section 1. But Section 1 over the last 5 years has been down.
And while we're on the budget cuts that we did in this last recently completed budget session, I appreciate the university biannualizing those cuts. Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
And with respect to, that's the Section 1 budget. The other portion of the budget is Section 2. And there has been some growth in the Section 2 budget over the years. That includes auxiliary services, which are just recouping charges for what the university does and charges for students, et cetera. Those entities that operate on campus and need to collect fees to recover their costs. But in particular in Section 2, and Dr. Gern is here, over the years the research enterprise at the university has grown significantly. I believe you already addressed that this morning. But that has been a significant growth in the university's budget over time.
Yeah, is that shown under university funds? Or is there some of it federal funds or a little bit of both for the research component?
The research component is principally federal funds, but there's also what we call university funds, which includes those auxiliary unit charges, and there's a little, and that's the bulk of it in Section 2.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Arlie, just by way of introducing her, Arlie is actually a very experienced legislative staffer. From New Mexico and Arizona. She's got a lot of experience doing basically the same thing that Don and I and Steve and Alex and a lot of us have done here. So it was a real treat, let me tell you, to walk into that place and find Arlie on staff and doing great things for that place. And I think when you see details of how those budget reductions were put in place, a lot of that you can thank Arlie for that work. And so by saying that, I want to tell you she has put together this document, this analysis of university funding called the University Dashboard. We'll make sure that everybody on this committee gets that because I think it will answer a lot of your historic questions. It'll answer a lot of your questions that might have to do with distributions of student populations. And ultimately, as you're making decisions about compensation, she's one of the most overprepared people I've ever seen as far as
you know what I'd like
so
to have you do that could reduce it to something that would really be valuable to me is, and I being an engineer, I like numbers and statistics. So like over a period of time, and I don't know whether you want to use 5 years or 7 years, but you can look at the relevance of changes that might occur so you can come up with the time frame that you want and show the funding levels and the state part, the all the different levels, try to break out research because that's a huge component of it, and then show the student population during those times. I think that would be a good thing to be able to see.
Chairman, I think also, you know, the general funds, the SER and medical education, those things that don't pop right up in your Section 1.
And the number of employees.
General fund, state aid, number of employees.
And we also have that over $80,000 for the university, don't we, Don?
You do.
So we've already got that information.
You
and
do,
I
Mr.
think
Chairman.
There's, yeah, we've got that information. Anything else, committee, that you'd like to have on that kind of a – Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at page 9 here. I think that has quite a little bit of what we're doing. I guess we've got general funds for fiscal year 13-14, federal funds for the same years. Other funds, I'm assuming that's tuition. That might be the wrong assumption. I haven't got into the narrative, and that does exclude medical education and SER. So is it that kind of gives us the broad overall snapshot, and did I make the right assumption on the other funds, or what is other funds?
Mr. Chairman, pretty close. First of all, SER, I do believe, is in this. Second of all, other funds includes more than just tuition.
Yeah.
It's the catch-all, but the majority of that, I think it's safe to say, is tuition.
The other component is, and when I and Senator Massey provided me with some documentation about regionalized tuition comparisons, and we're bottom. We're the lowest. Show me if there's any kind of correlation between budgets and tuition increases, and what we've done, and what kind of tuition we've increased over the past 5, 6, 7 years. See, what I'm thinking, Dick, is you know, the legislature, we have limited resources, and we understand the salary component, but at least I, for one, think that part of it should be made up with tuition increases, too. And so it's a balance between of all of these different components to come up with what we might be able to get to where you're looking at. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, interestingly enough, and I don't mean to speak for Dick here, but the Student Senate supports that idea as well. So kind of interesting coming from
Chairman,
the students.
And I think also, you know, tuition is the smallest kind of part of going to Laramie. I think that, you know, this total cost of attendance piece is a huge part that's steadily climbed. And I guess, so I saw the five-year numbers, and you're right, we've had two budget cuts in those 5 years. But really, let's take a look back 10 years. I'd like to see how it's changed, where we're at now, and really that total cost of attendance has got to be a piece of that, too.
So, right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Arlie has done a spectacular job of having all that pretty much ready to go. You'll have it in short order.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of Arlie while she's... Senator Perkins.
Just to clarify, so on the when we're looking at page 9 of the budget, we've got this with section 1, and then is this a section 1? When you were talking about section 1, and then you were talking about section 2, are we still talking apples and apples? Have we switched into apples and oranges now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, this on page 9 is the section 1 budget.
Okay.
This is just section 1.
Okay.
These federal funds that you see here are funds that are received by the College of Agriculture that are dedicated to the College of operating for the college because of the university's land grant status. And those show up in Section 1. All of the research, sponsored research programs, competitive grant awards, et cetera, that come through the federal government, those are over in the Section 2 budget. You're seeing just Section 1 here.
Okay, Bill, continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think that takes us to the summary on 14 and 15, which we pretty much just walked through that already. Given that it's...
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. I'm not sure who the appropriate person to answer this question is, Mr. Chairman, but I'm curious to know or get some background on how UW managed its merit pay increases over the past 5 or 10 years versus for various... staffing and professors versus no merit pay, and how the system operates, particularly out of Section 2, if it's different from Section 1 dollars, in terms of, obviously, you asked to have a merit pay and have it distributed the way you wanted to out of a block grant, essentially. The governor said he wants something different. I'd like to know how UW generally manages their merit pay, who has it, and if they were given the last few years or 5 years, and how it works, please.
Yeah, and part of that component, too, is the reclassification, we call it. What actually happens within the university in terms of reclassification? We're seeing a lot of that in other areas of government where changes are made, and, you know, they just reclassify, and usually I haven't seen where it's cost less to reclassify. It usually costs more. Is that what you're kind of getting at, too, Bob? And, Dick, we don't want to get into your block grant. I mean, that's your baby. We just want to see and have a feel for what's going on.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think you're exactly right, and we've seen this all of our agencies. No pay raises the last 4 or 5 years, but in effect, through reclassification, employees are getting pay raises in most agencies. So maybe somehow this breakdown of how that's happened at the university, the average salary, and how it's changed.
Mr. Chairman, we can get you that information, and probably the best thing for us to do is to work with Don and the co-chairs to make sure we're getting you what you want. I think anecdotally, I don't think you see at the university the really a reclass per se. I think what you see are people moving from job to job, and that might be from department to department or whatever it is.
We see a lot of that also in state government.
Sure,
and,
Mr. Chairman.
Saw a lot of it yesterday, in fact. So.
Right, Mr. Chairman, and we do keep statistics on all of that. Then there's the whole faculty side of the thing, and that part of it.
Yeah, and vacant positions is always a question as well. How many vacant positions you have? There again, it's your block grant. It's up to you, but I wonder how many vacancies you do have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on the staff side of this thing, I can answer that question pretty easily. I think because we had there's a new federal mandate for some veterans preference hiring and whatnot, and so we're trying to figure out how to get a person hired to take care of that. And my first question to personnel was, how many vacant positions do we have, and where are they, how much do they pay, and all that. And it fit on a sheet about that long. There, I would guess there might have been around 20 positions.
Not very many.
Not very many.
Okay. Senator Meyer.
Bill, one thing that we were trying to get from the budget office, and you said you keep statistics on that, is that they were counting people that moved from one job to another job within a division or between agencies as turnover. And we necessarily didn't agree that was actually turnover. Turnover to us was like somebody left the whole institution and you hired somebody from outside of the institution. I didn't know whether your statistics would show that type of a differentiation.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't really looking at it in that term, Senator, or in that context, I guess, but we'll dig into it and see what we can get you.
You know what I think we're going to do, Dick, is it's 10:45. You know, I don't think we'll get through this by noon, so would you be available, you and your people, to come back after lunch? Okay, and if there's somebody that within your group that has something to say, that has a commitment, we sure honor that opportunity for them. And, Don, what I want to do is the people we have set up for 1 o'clock, move them back about an hour. Is that okay with the committee? And then we'll just we'll try to get through it by – what times does the San Diego play Denver tonight? No. I didn't say that. Okay, please continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, page 17 is a summary of the state aid component of this, and you can see that's essentially all general fund, except the governor has recommended some SIPA account funding going forward. And as you mentioned, the budget reductions from FY 2014 were doubled up in 15-16. With a little bit of an exception as far as the SER component.
Let's talk about that. The former president, I think, when he made those budget reductions, there were a sizable number of people, and I don't know whether they were vacant positions or whether they were actually live bodies. And could you give us an idea what that was? Were they vacant? Were they live bodies? Because there was, it seems to me, 40 or 50. That was a number of reductions that occurred, and a lot of it was in, most of it was in what I call development instead of the academia side, and I wonder how you feel about that, because to me development is a big part of what the whole mission is about. But anyway, do we have that number?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, on the faculty side, it was 12 vacant faculty.
They were vacant
positions. Yep. And on the staff side, it was 42 vacant staff positions.
So there were no pink slips?
There were no pink slips given this time. That's correct.
Okay.
Let's see here, Mr. Chairman. Pages 20 and 21 making the request for the compensation component. Again, as we talked, that's, that's removed into a uniform or unified approach from the governor's office.
Mr. Chairman.
Governor Nicholas.
Thank you, and sorry to interrupt, Bill, but I had some questions. Could you give us some specific examples or, if you would, about the out-migration issue and who, I mean, are we really losing our top-tier professors, and if so, why? And just give us kind of more nuts and bolts as opposed to just in that broad perspective.
Bill?
Mr. Chairman, do you want a written response to that, or do you want to talk to the guy that can talk to you about it?
I'd like to hear a little bit, yeah.
Let's hear a little bit. Would you get a mic, please?
Sorry. I think there's
the hand.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, my experience of this issue has lasted about 4 months. I can tell you that previous to that, I wasn't paying attention to it. I was heard anecdotal stories, and what I have for you are anecdotal studies, but or stories, excuse me. But Bill, I'm going to ask you to say a few words on this in a minute. But what we are facing is the reality that some of the brightest and most valuable faculty we have are being recruited by marquee name schools, my alma mater being one, and they because of what they perceive to be the higher compensation, they're tempted and in some cases choose to leave. In terms of numbers and how that has trended over the course of time, I can't answer that question. I'm sure we can, but I can't answer it right this minute. I know that we've done some work on it, but these are professors who attract significant R&D funding, and so the loss of them is not just the loss of a valued teacher and a valued researcher, but it's a loss of significant revenue too, and that's why it is an issue. And, Bill, could I just ask you to maybe give some representative numbers? We haven't looked at that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, do you mind if I stand instead of come around?
Please identify yourself, Bill, for
yes,
the record.
Yes, I'm Bill Gurn, Vice President for Research and Economic Development, and I'm also a professor of zoology and physiology at the University of Wyoming. Let me just give you two or three examples. We lost Randy Lewis. That was perhaps the largest loss we had. He was a molecular biology professor. He was the person who has us. We have several patents still, which we own on spider silk. And spider silk is a wonderful material that can be used for a variety of things. We lost him to Utah State University, where he was made a Utah Star professor. That was a tremendous loss. We lost Elise Pindle. Elise is a professor of botany. She is heading, and my point about her is that she's heading for Australia. This is an international marketplace. We have great professors that are wanted worldwide. We lost her to an Australian university. Another professor that we lost is Steve Jackson. Steve Jackson is another botany professor. Steve left for a position actually with the federal government, with the USGS, and an appointment at the University of Arizona. All of these are our best, and it just demonstrates that this is a really powerful marketplace that we are competing in.
What's a star professor? What is that?
U-Star professor is that there are select professors throughout the state of Utah. They are identified either within Utah or from around the world, and these are people they want. And so they are in a special category of professors, and they can exist at any one of the Utah public universities, so University of Utah, Utah State, Weber, etc. And they can exist in any one of these universities, and they are people who are just picked off because they have importance as perceived by Utah.
What are they offered different than
Representative
we
Nicholas.
Don't? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. What are they offered differently that we don't?
Bill?
They offer large salaries. They offer other things like technicians. They offer research funding, direct research funding, instead of applying for research funds. So that in addition to applying for research funds, they also receive state funding. So they're given graduate students, for example, highly competitive graduate students, which is another marketplace that we are in. It's a strong
one. Representative Nicholas.
So, Mr. Chairman, for those type of professors, offering a 4% raise isn't going to do much, is it?
Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas. It might not, but let me give you an example of something that did. We had, and I'm not going to name names in this case, but I will be glad to talk to anybody about it privately. We just had Harvard make a very strong approach at two of our professors, and we were able to work preemptively to make it appealing to stay at Wyoming. And so we did that. And so there is it isn't just about the money, I guess is what I would say. this person, Harvard is a tremendous and powerful magnet for professors, but this person wanted to raise children in Wyoming. So there is an advantage that we have, and we need to understand what those advantages are and play off of them. And sometimes it works, and in this case it did.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
And I think that's really important, and I guess my question will go back. Is this one of the things that you're going to be addressing in the strategic plan? I mean, ultimately recognizing what we are, who we are, and play to those strengths as opposed to try and be things that we aren't.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman.
This is where you start earning the big bucks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins. The answer is yes, because it must be. The faculty, again, using business analogies, the faculty is really the engine of the university. It produces the product are the students, but also the research. And the flip side of the problems that or the losses, let's say, that Vice President Gern has just described. The flip side of that, which the legislature has enabled us to pursue, is the Tier 1 initiative. It provides the resources, and Dr. Gossam has developed a very specific plan to employ the financial resources coming to the University of Wyoming, matched with private money, to go out and essentially acquire, the services of professors in target areas of excellence for the university in a very methodical way, which, if time permits, we'll describe that to you, and we have a handout for it. But that's the way to address this brain drain, let's call it, or the competition for talent that Vice President Gern described. That's the way to address it. You need to pick the places where you want to be good. You have to identify the faculty resources that will enable you to get good or to improve if you are already good, and to provide the teaching of graduate students that leverage the capability, and also, very importantly, attract the funding from private sector sources, industry, that are interested in this, in the expertise that's available there to work on their problems. And in the case of the energy industry, obviously their problems or their issues are also Wyoming's issues. But again, to return to the question, that's what a plan for a university needs to do, and that's what it will do.
Co-chair, you?
Mr. Chairman, just the talk about the U-Star professor, and he said very large salaries. Never did. I mean, so was it Professor Lewis who left? I mean, was there a salary? Just, I know these are all, but what did he, how much more money did he make at Utah State than Wyoming? Mm-hmm. When you say Utah, I mean, they're a border state. Comparative land grant institution.
Right. Mr. Chairman, may I address that question, then I'll turn it back over to Bill. But Representative Harshman, a current example, again, a name I won't mention, but it is a professor on the faculty that I happen to know very well and whose work I'm familiar with. It's not in finance, but I will tell you that this individual is a world-class star. And he is receiving feelers from other institutions. I don't know them, but at a salary that's 25% higher than he's being paid currently, and he's an established professor with a worldwide reputation.
Which would be how much?
$200,000.
Representative or Senator Dockstetter, you got your mic on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just quickly, are we given an opportunity, Mr. President, to counteract or to that preemptive strike that was noted? Are we given opportunities in most cases to counteroffer?
In some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. It would probably vary. But would it not be fair to say, Bill, that it's usually we would have a chance? So usually we do. What I can tell you is that it's a resource, it's a funding question, ordinarily. I come back to the planning issue. This issue has not been, or had not been, comprehensively addressed by the prior administration. Bob Sternberg, while he was here and while I was serving as Vice President of Academic Affairs, said, this is a problem you need to get on and figure out how to solve. And that being not only have many faculty members suffered the effects of flat incomes or, in real terms, declining incomes over the last 4 to 5 years or so, but we're also below market. And as you would know who've run a business, if you need a very specific expertise to run your operation well or to serve clients in a certain way, you go find them, and it's not hard to find them.
I think what we're looking for, too, Representative Nicholas, see if you would agree with me, is, you know, it's hard. You know, there are isolated examples, and we understand that. But really, that'll always be there. There will always be opportunities for the kind of talent we have at the university for someone to want to recruit them. And they may want to leave for all kinds of reasons. That will always happen. And when I look at my business, and from a business perspective, because of the size of my companies, what we do is we really train for the big boys. And we understand that. We bring them on. We teach them. They learn. They produce. They perform for us. And then they're gone. And there's a little bit of that happens with the university. But what I think we need to know is the bigger perspective in terms of is it 100 professors that we're talking about, or is it 30? How many of them is it really? And I don't want you to talk about it now, but when you give the numbers to us, what number are we talking about? And that's one thing I don't know. How many professors are in that, what you say, in that category that we think we need to protect, and how many of them, how many have we lost? And so that would be, is that what you're looking for, Representative Nicholas, something like that? Or?
Oh, that would be useful. But as I understand it, one of the functions of the university should be, if you lose a top-tier star professor, you've got to have enough funding for that person that's right below him or is going to take his place that he can move into that position and will be equally as capable or you know, you're not going to lose them both. So you're training really not for just a star but for that faculty genre. To me, you need more than just a star.
That is true. What makes a strong faculty, what makes a tier one faculty, however, is the combination of skills in the group. And these professors of the type we're talking about are unique, almost one of a kind. You usually tend not to have two. You're certainly training graduate students to come along. You might have some postdocs also. It's necessary to think of a group of faculty as a group, not a hierarchical structure. Particularly in the way that we're trying to evolve, you need I'll call them clusters. But if you're trying to deal with complex issues, you need an array of talents to go into addressing those issues, as we're organizing to do even now in the College of Engineering. So it's not simply a matter of having a lieutenant step up to the role of captain if the captain gets transferred elsewhere or something dire happens. It's much more of a unit where the individual skills are put together for a purpose. Kind of like analogous to a SEAL team, probably, where you've got 6 or 7 specialists in certain things that together make the thing more than the sum of its parts. It's philosophy.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines, and maybe just the other side of the same coin, what luck does the university have? What's our success in recruiting these top people from other schools? I imagine the university does the same thing as raid other schools for top talent.
Who do you want to answer that? I'll answer it.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Bill.
Representative Burkhardt, thank you for asking. We search literally worldwide, and we are very successful at hiring at the entry level. And so we are able to hire the people that we're interested in for the most part. Not every time, but we don't... we will not continue a search if we think that the candidate pool is not strong enough. We'll stop the search and then start again. So we have been successful at the entry level. It is what happens over time with that entry level as they advance in their careers. And that's when they get to be, we made the analogy, it's like being a AAA farm team in baseball. We don't, we hire great people, they build themselves up, they become known to our competitors, and then they go get them. And so we have to be able to fight that off. And that is, so I think we're good at the start, and we've got to develop mechanisms whereby we can retain our very top ones. An example would be how we would use our block grant if we had a war chest that we could fight off, use to fight off competitors, and then use the block grant internally to then pay ourselves back so that we could adjust the salaries over time. Those kinds of things would be very helpful to us as we move forward in these kinds of things. There was a discussion, and this would be my last comment, there was a discussion about how do we keep our best students, high school students, from leaving Wyoming. It's a reputational issue. They want to go where there's good reputations. That reputation is the reputation of the faculty. And so that's why it's so important. That's another reason why it's so important to keep our
faculty. And part of that, Bill, is as a student, when you're thinking about that, it's the faculty that you're concerned about, but it's knowing that you're going to have the real good job opportunities, and they're going to look at the University of Wyoming. They're going to say as a corporate world, wow, we want to go to Wyoming and look at recruiting. That's a big part of it.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's Bill.
Bill.
In support of what Bill Gurn is saying and what Dick is saying, the assistant professor level where they're hiring these guys at, our current average salary is about 89% of our comparators for those guys, and so they're having some success there, about 89%. When you move up the ranks, it drops to 88%, and then when you get to full professor, it drops clear down to 84% of those comparator institutions. That sort of goes back to a question I wanted to answer that Bob asked, and I'm not sure that you got an answer to it.
Let us know.
You know, Mr. Co-Chair, thing on that comparator institutions, and if you can shoot us a list of those two. I know we've asked for, probably seen it, but need some re-education on that.
Mr. Chairman, we absolutely can do that, and yeah. Interestingly, we have sliced and diced that thing a number of different ways, and it's roughly the same no matter which ones you select. It's a pretty interesting comparison, and we have it by the actual, not just aggregated, but by the individual comparator institution. So you can look at some of these surrounding states and see what they look like.
And I think what you'll see is the places that charge more for tuition will have the higher pays. I'll bet that'll be in there. Okay, please continue. Yes, Dick.
Mr. Chairman, Bill asked, you wanted to...
Mr. Chairman, Bob had asked a question about the 4%. What good is the 4% going to do you? And,
go ahead.
And I did want to respond to that because I think the 4% that, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, it is.
Bob, the 4% piece that's reflected in this budget is, I think there's some pretty clear identification there that there was no intent ever to give 4% across the board COLA to everybody. The idea is get a chunk of salary money out there and have it available for the things that Bill's talking about, but also get some basic base level pay adjustments to the rest of the staff too that you want to keep around.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perkins. Turn your mic on. What? Oh, Senator Hastert.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's been an awful lot of discussion around. Starting with Senator Esquivel's question of keeping, attracting the students, and it, obviously I think that was one of the thoughts I had was hit right here, and the fact that it's reputation, and people I've talked to said that the School of Law has a great reputation, and and then the issues that the university has of retaining, and I don't know if it's something that, it's certainly not something that needs to be done today, but I wondered if they could develop or have, if they have a plan, or if they would, or what it would take for the university to put a plan together to say, okay, you know, that obviously getting the entry level isn't the issue, it's the retention down the road. What would a plan look like to better facilitate, or what do we need to do to help better facilitate keeping those best and brightest in, you know, to the University of Wyoming? What does that plan look like? And that's just something that, you know, maybe you could think about, at, you know, having, you know, bring to the JAC at some point. And, you know, I certainly have a lot of experience with, when you use the analogy of a baseball team, you know, just, we don't want to be the Indians of the colleges.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. I just, good question. I'm just wondering, it sounds like professional football is salary cap. But anyway, maybe you designate your franchise professors. And but my question to you is, how do the, or to what extent is there a way, if not already, that we're integrating the endowed chairs into this type of a process? And what effect does that have, or how does that have any interplay with this conversation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, an excellent example of that is the detail that surrounds what we would like to tell you about the implementation of the task force mandate to achieve Tier 1. Actually, the mandate was Tier 1 across the university, but starting with energy and engineering. Dr. Gossam can talk about the details of that. But put simply, you designate excellence professors, or you recruit professors, experienced high-profile faculty with specific and recognized expertise in areas important to you. It's like staffing a baseball team or a football team in specific positions, and that's why, you know, you do need a bench, but usually the second string is not quite as good as the first, and you target recruiting for specific institutional purposes and ways in which you want to outcompete your competition. We've talked about comparator institutions. They should not be called comparator as some neutral academic term. These are competitors, and they are seeking to recruit the best players at specific positions that are important to them. That is the kind of, but you have to do it pursuant to a plan. I will, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll observe to Senator Hastert that it is essential that we have such a plan. We do have it in engineering now. We did not before. We have it as a result of the Tier 1 initiative. We need to have it much more broadly. I cannot promise you that we will have it by the time the legislature convenes or departs, but your asking for such a plan is exactly what the Board of Trustees is doing and what you should be wanting to see from us, and we will do it. But we need to be very, very specific about the kinds of people that we want, because we are competing in a global market.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
And this may be more for Brett than for the university folks, but I just wanted some clarification on the governor's recommendation, and we find it on the salary issues throughout the budget, that this be handled using a statewide approach to employee compensation. And is that just meaning the 2.5% compounded, or is it intended to mean something more broadly about how that compensation is distributed?
Brett, turn it on, see if it works.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, I think probably some of both. It is, I think, specific to the nature of the proposal that he's presented to the legislature for the current or for the upcoming biennium. But I think even more broadly, I think philosophically, he's looking at the compensation issues as it relates to all branches, the university, the community colleges, wanting some consistency in terms of how all of those entities who seek state funding associated with compensation are handled and essentially looking for that unified approach in terms of compensation. While I think still recognizing some the difference between academia and government in general.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up, because I guess as I would envision it, you know, with a block grant, you're plopping more money into the block grant, but is the governor requesting that something else be done other than just the additional money as part of the state aid?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, I think there's a recognition that in the context of the block grant that the university has certain methodologies it's historically used in terms of distributing the compensation dollars that it essentially receives from the state. So there's that recognition that they have their own methodologies and practices for how compensation is distributed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that answered the question.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stubson, could you repeat the question for me, please?
I think it answered mine, but maybe Representative Nicholas has another one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, do you have another question?
Mr. Chairman, even though you recognize their block grant distribution of funds, is the governor asking for a general across-the-board 2.5% for every employee of the state of Wyoming or a university employee, or is it something different?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I guess I thought I did answer that question. I think there's a recognition on the part of the governor that the university has methodologies within the block grant in their organization through which they do distribution of compensation increases from the state.
I suppose, Mr. Chairman, recognizing it and wanting it, or just, I guess, I was changed.
I think the reality of it is, Bob, is that whatever money goes to the university in their block grant will be distributed how they want to do it. And that's the way it'll be, and that's the intent. I don't think we want to get into telling the university that it should be across the board. I don't think, unless you want to. I don't. Okay, let's continue. And this is good discussion about these salaries, because, you know, one of the things that as we all come down here as members of the legislature, we have to balance. We have to balance the revenues, the demands of the state, and all. And you know, the governor certainly had to do it with $500 million worth of requests that he narrowed down to what, Brett, 50, 40, 50, 60 million. And so there are all these pressures on us, and we just need to balance that and see how it fits with all the other demands our constituency has. And someone said earlier it's the University of Wyoming, not the University of Laramie. So please continue.
Mr. Chairman, pages 22 and 23, part of 24, deal with that IT backbone component, that wireless backbone component. We discussed that.
Yeah, do we have a three-year institution that has not received accreditation? And why not? It's on page 24.
Mr. Chairman, are we talking BSL 3?
Yep. You want to get back to us on that one?
I'm not sure I understand that question,
Don,
Mr. Chairman.
Don, explain it, would you please?
I think you mean it's a three-year-old facility that has not yet received CDC accreditation.
Right, Mr. Chairman.
That's what I said.
Right. I guess I was wondering whether there were questions, Mr. Chairman, on that backbone component, that wireless backbone component. Moving on to BSL 3, that's the lab that had the inversion problem. Part of the operations and maintenance request that we talked about earlier actually did have to do with the accreditation of this thing, or certification of the lab. Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but I would ask if we can back up so I can ask Representative Harshman something.
Sure, go ahead.
Steve, did you want to talk to Bob Aylward about this wireless backbone?
Yeah, we
component?
Want to get into that too.
Well, I would. I guess a little more information and how this WiMAX. I don't even got to explain it to me. I guess a little bit how that fits in, if it does.
Mr. Chairman.
In regards to, there's two
Please
issues.
Identify yourself.
Sorry. Robert Aylward. I run the Information Technology Group at the University of Wyoming. There was a question about WiMAX. This is not WiMAX. This is Wi-Fi, and there are two different types of technologies. Either one of them have to be built out in order to serve the campus community. So an analogy might be cell phone towers. You can have a cell phone tower that would provide service to X number of subscribers, but as that number of subscribers increases, you have to have more cell phone towers. Our current Wi-Fi system that's on campus is very similar to what you would experience going to an airport or going to a Starbucks and connecting your personal device to that Wi-Fi system. That's what we have at the University of Wyoming. That's a 7-year-old system, and as you probably are well aware of, technology is a perishable item, so you have to replenish it and replace it, and that's what we're attempting to do. We do have a WiMAX system. That system we use fairly extensively to connect our remote buildings around campus directly into our campus backbone. The wireless system that we want to expand is Wi-Fi, and Wi-Fi is typically what's in, again, the cell phones, tablets, laptops, those types of things. WiMAX is not built into those systems. So WiMAX has a very unique, specialized need. What we're trying to do is replace our Wi-Fi system, upgrade it, and broaden it. It's the number one request we get from students is for more Wi-Fi service. So I don't know if that answered the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
We need education. I've heard this WiMAX is underutilized, potentially pretty powerful, and it's kind of sitting partially dormant. Maybe it could be ramped up, but it won't provide the same Wi-Fi capabilities into your students or the city of Laramie or those folks.
That's correct. It can be ramped up, and it would be a service to potentially, so for instance, if we wanted to serve the homes of faculty, staff, and students that would be in the Laramie area, we would use WiMAX, but that would require them to actually put an antenna on their house, and then that would connect in. For just generally walking around on campus with your laptop or your cell phone or anything like that, it would not meet those needs.
Okay, so there's two separate systems. This WiMAX thing, do we support that with, is that a federal grant or is that some general fund dollars support that?
The WiMAX system that we have in place is a system that's provided by the university through primarily Section 2 funds, actually through revenue that we've generated internally. Like I said, we use it primarily to connect our administrative buildings because it has a much longer range than Wi-Fi does, and it's more specialized in that regard. It can be expanded, but again, it can't be expanded for the particular use we're trying to get accomplished here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Yeah, Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on this system. If the... the request was approved and the system was put in, what's the life expectancy? When will we have to replace it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhart, that's a good question. As I mentioned, all technology is perishable. Ideally, almost all of the technologies that we utilize would be replaced in a 4-year time frame, whether they be servers, whether they be data storage, whether they be wireless communication, whether they be the backbone network. We typically go far beyond the shelf life. We're typically at this system right now. We're looking to replace it, and it's 7 years old. By the time we get it replaced, it'll be closer to 8 years old if we're fortunate enough to get the funding to do that.
Yeah, and I'm looking at your reports, and this is the funding request is for the second phase, and we're going to, seven different buildings or departments, correct?
So there's a couple of different pieces in this request. The primary piece is, in fact, the Wi-Fi system, the wireless system. There is also a backbone component in there, and that is also we're asking to replace the core backbone component of that. And then there's also a storage component in this request. As you can imagine, if you look at your own laptop or cellular device or anything that you see advertised, and like the iPhone, for instance, it offers 16 gigabytes of service, but you can upgrade that to 64 gigabytes. Those types of things. So the storage demand that we have is also exponentially increasing just because data gets bigger and bigger. And then the network capacity is able to transfer that data, in particular for researchers' needs, for the computational sciences.
And we had an opportunity to go to the UW Data Center, and I, as I understand it, that now is almost capacity, a lot of it because of NCAR, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, we are getting close. That data center was originally thought to be designed for about 20 years. We're now into year five, and we're three quarters full.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple things on the wireless piece then. How do you secure that? I mean, it's not a deal that drifts over to Laramie proper, and Senator Nicholas was getting free Wi-Fi from his house.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point, and I don't know if you've driven by a Starbucks, but it's similar to a certain extent. Now, that said, we have two types of services on campus, just to let you know. So if you come to the campus community, you'll see a wireless guest access. And that wireless guest access allows you to connect to the Internet for web browsing. And that's because we have visiting people, we have visiting scholars. You might come on campus and want to be able to connect as well. So we have a guest access, and then we have an authenticated access. The authenticated access provides a much higher level, higher robustness of service as well, and you have to be a UW student, faculty, or staff to connect into that. But for the people that do live on the fringe of the campus community, they can connect to the guest access, but they get limited access. And that's, unfortunately, we just can't draw a wall that shuts down wireless.
Mr. Chairman, and then that storage piece, you know, the state government and ETS were, it's our understanding, limited understanding, I'd add, that we're not really in the server business anymore. We're going to an all-cloud-based system, and I see you're another $1 million for servers. Where are you at with that, with cloud versus service?
Mr. Chairman, our approach is cloud first, just to let you know. We do look at the cloud to begin with, and if it's economical, we'll go to the cloud. It still hasn't quite crossed the threshold where it becomes more economical for most of our things to go to the cloud. Some of them, it is more economical. Even those, though, have a cost. And it's really not so much the infrastructure itself, where it is. It's the fact that the exponential demand of technology in general and data storage and the transmission of data, those types of things are driving it. So really, whether we're in the cloud or whether we're on-premise, we'll take the most economical option, but we look at them both. And right now, data storage is still quite a bit much more economical to do on-site.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that we have an arrangement between state government and the university, the Commvault process, where we're backing up stuff over at your place and you're backing up stuff over here. And is that the same exact infrastructure that is included in this data storage that's being filled up by the NCAR? Situation?
Mr. Chairman, it's not the same data storage, but you're absolutely correct, Representative Wallace. We back up the state's data every day in Laramie, and they back up our data in Cheyenne. And that's so that if either facility, a tornado would come through or something like that, we still have the data. We don't have the computers, but we still have the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, in having the data. They are different storage platforms, however. It's not the identical storage platform, but part of this is, in fact, to expand that backup data for us.
And that's the fiber that the state more or less paid for that goes from Cheyenne all the way to Rock Springs. It's only lit up between here and Laramie. The rest of it's dark, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is basically correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. And how are we doing with that capacity? Are we going to be needing to look at expanding that in the near future, or how far out, and how big of a deal is that going to be for us as we look down the road?
Mr. Chairman, the beauty of what we have by having this fiber between us, it's what's called dark fiber. And that fiber allows us to, for very reasonable cost, increase the capacity, because essentially what we do is we just add additional light waves on that. We add the pieces of equipment at the end that dramatically increases the capacity of that. So right now we're running at 10 gigabits per second, but by increasing the electronics at either end of that, we can essentially go almost unlimited, certainly unlimited for the near term.
question I have, it's more of a general question, and have we in the past, maybe Don can answer this too, if we give general fund money for IT stuff at the university as a matter of expansion in the budgets, or is this kind of a one-time deal?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there are several areas where we have appropriated, or the legislature has appropriated general funds, the classrooms, which you visited about earlier, the construction of the facility, as well as for operations.
I guess the other question, with your internal funds in the block grant, how much of your funding for these areas do you do with your internal funds that are not requested specifically of the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, if one of the things, so there we had, I brought forward a list initially of over $10 million in things that we can't really afford to do internally with our own internal funding for placement and those types of things. Of that, we brought forward from the university $2.8 million of that request. So we do have, our budget does go, in fact, to attempting to replenish these where we can. This is beyond that capability of to being able to replenish it.
Dick, you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, just a further comment on that. I talked about the planning process on which we are embarked. It will involve not only academic matters, but also, shall we say, administrative and support matters. Each of the vice presidents has an administrative unit for which he or she is responsible. Each of them need plans also. And so, for example, there's a we obviously as an institution we need to take a longer term look at technology needs, and that needs to be a long term look. And it will be taken, and we'll be making some estimates about further fleshing out what Robert has already done.
Okay, any other questions? The only last question I would have is, what's more important, the wireless or the servers?
Mr. Chair, I think they're both critical needs. And again, in fact, it's not going to cover what we've got to come up with internally to replenish it. Wireless, I would have to say, it's the number one request we get from students is for their connectivity. The average student now has over 2.5 wireless devices that they carry around with them. So from a student perspective, I'd have to say it's the wireless. Internally, for the operations of the university, I'd have to say it's the servers.
Senator Hastert.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, I'm not sure where to go with this other than reading an article a month or so ago, it just talked about how the United States as a whole is ranked like number 9 on a list of countries as far as technology for for internet speed and for all of that kind of stuff. And it seems to me like in all of the conversations that we've been having around here, it always seems to be like, what are we going to be able to do to keep up? And we just bought this technology and we're already behind, and I just wondered if maybe the university wouldn't be an opportunity to try and see what they could do to get us ahead of the curve a little bit, and have Wyoming be some place in the country that has kind of jumps a few leaps and bounds and what that would look like.
Mr. Chairman, I would say I think under Governor Mead and the new CIO there, Flint Waters, I think they're making phenomenal progress, I think, in doing some of those things, in particular the governor's broadband initiative and moving that up. A past CEO of the Wyoming Business Council said, this was many years ago, said behind airline service, broadband is the number one thing that you need for economic development. That's still true today. And so I think that the state CIO is trying to do to create a similar type structure to what the university already has for redundancy will go a long way in that regard. But that said, I think it is critical to note that technology is an investment, and it's one that you have to replenish frequently if you want to keep up to date.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, and that was exactly what I wanted to just point out, is that I don't see everybody, this is just something I see is going to be something that we have to deal with everybody any of them right now, and just being able to keep up with world demands.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
just a second.
Just one more question before we pass the mic.
Could you, if possible, give us your professional opinion of how what our ETS program is doing for the state? And
well, from what I've seen from Mr. Chairman, from what I've seen from the outside, I'd say it's doing wonderful things and things that have probably should have been done 20 years ago, in a lot of regards. Mm.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, with your, I'd like to go back to Senator Hastert's question for just a moment.
If you want his vote, you better call him Hastert.
Sorry. Hastert. Senator Hastert. The question is, your question had to do with technology in particular. I'd just like to point out that the governor's Tier 1 agenda for the university deals with that same issue. In other words, it's asking the university how to develop itself so that it is a leader in those fields in which it wants to be a leader, not just in this in technology or support services, but also in those the areas of academic distinction that we've identified. And with further, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, Vice President Gern would like to make a comment.
Bill.
Okay, this will be brief. Mr. Chairman, you've already made a tremendous investment in NCAR, and we're fully utilizing that investment, and we're being recognized actually worldwide as a place where computational science is done. So investments do bring results is what I would say.
Okay, let's get moving along, Bill. We're going to go down to priority four, the biological safety level, BSL-3.
You bet, Mr. Chairman. Page 24 and 25, part of 26. Again, that was a request for operational funding and maintenance funding to get this thing up and running. We do have the issue of the reverse flow that basically kind of wrecked that lab. I would point out on page 24, and I'm being facetious about wreck the lab, because the lab is not wrecked. It just needs to be fixed. But got to be careful what you say in here. I understand. Page 24 under A, I think it's important to point out the bottom of that paragraph. The project planning, design, and construction was managed by State Construction Management Division. So it is kind of this weird handoff. So it's this lab that's attached to the state vet lab, and it's it handles a lot of pretty virulent stuff. So important to get that thing up and moving. All part of the plan out there. So on page 26, you'll see the governor recommended half of that funding amount, and I think what that does is basically fund it for 1 year, which makes it a bit challenging to get those people hired. Let's see here. Moving on to, I think, the next.
This is where the governor cut it in half, so he did some one-year funding. Is that right, Brett? Is that the rationale behind it? Or?
Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm not sure if that is the rationale behind it or not. I know that there was some dialogue with the university, but I think that's something that maybe we need to follow up on in terms of what the actual need is here. I know that the request was submitted for twice that amount, but I know that there was some discussion with them as well as to what the appropriate amount actually needed to be at this time.
Mr.
Chris?
Mr. Chairman, and I'll tell you, Mr. Chairman, a part of that miscommunication was on my part in speaking with the governor's office. As we were looking at some delays in the facility being repaired and then up and running, it was my mistake in suggesting that perhaps one-year funding would be appropriate. These folks need to begin hiring the people that are going to run this place. They need to begin. Obviously, once it is repaired, the funding must be in place for federal certification, and the funding level that is described in the governor's recommendation, and I have visited with the governor's office about this, and the governor's office has given the university the permission to sort of sidestep the governor's recommendation in this case. This is not something the university is going to do regularly, but that it really, in order to get this facility certified, never mind getting it repaired, the full amount is the appropriate amount.
So what you're saying is you're going to, if it stays the way it is, you're going to find the money somewhere else and do what you need to do? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, I think what I'm saying is we're going to seek support from the governor to change
Double
his
it.
Recommendation. And my hope is that we would be able to get a recommendation from the governor to that effect.
How do they determine that? I mean, to get certified, to, you know, these are kind of interesting requests that they're demanding of you. People, certain things. Is it like an RFP that they send? If you're going to be certified, A, B, C, D, E, and that's what we're doing? Or is this just kind of your gut feel of what we need?
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that it's not a gut feel, but I don't know the details of this in terms of
Okay, well, provide that to us, would
sure.
you please, especially if you're going to, the governor's going to come back with a letter that says they want the entire funding. The other thing, and Representative Moniz, is this the building that had the reverse air pressure situation and some collapsing
it
occurred?
It is, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question in regard to that. Can you certify the building that doesn't function because it's broken? Don't we need to fix the building first?
Mr. Chairman,
the
building needs to be fixed.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Over here, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Is this following up on Representative Moniz's comments? I mean, and fixing the building, I understand that there's a claim been made against the general contractor and things like that. Ultimately, are there funds in the budget to fix, or I know these are for operations. Is there other requests to fix, or are you guys handling that out of your self-insurance or whatever else you're going to do?
Bill? Mr. Chairman, it's developing right now. I've asked those same questions recently myself, and the interplay with construction management is part of this. The legal piece of it is part of it, and also, like I told you, the lead person that was working with us from the company that built this thing had some health issues, and we've been fighting that fight too. So I think it's on track. They're getting it figured out, and finally, you know, after a couple of days of pushing, frankly, is when we got the ballpark $1.25 million to fix this thing, because I'd heard numbers thrown around of $500,000 or $750,000, but nobody would give me anything on paper until the other day, and even that is qualified as a ballpark.
Mr. Chairman, follow up again.
Okay.
So what is the bottom line here? You requested whatever it was here, $1.3 million. That was just for maintenance and operation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And then you're talking another $1.2 million to fix the facility. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's going to be more than likely the cost of fixing it. Who's going to bear that cost is unknown at this point.
So okay. What's your bottom line? Sorry, Mr. Chairman. What's your bottom line request to make this facility functional?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the bottom line request, I think, is this operations and maintenance piece, the full 1.3. That's what's needed to make it work, but it's got to be repaired. It's a difficult question to answer, and I guess beyond saying this last piece, I'd turn it over to Rick Miller, because I think you get into this legal realm of whether there's responsibility to be assigned.
Well, we're not going to discuss legal theory. Anything else for the Moniz? Okay. I guess the only question I would ask, is there going to be from the governor's office, can we expect a letter requesting something like this, or is it going to be handled by the university, or we're not going to get involved in it? What do you think, Brett?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's that possibility. I haven't been privy to the conversation between the university and the governor's office on this particular issue to this point. But I'll inquire there. I would say there's a possibility of a letter with respect to this issue.
Okay. All right. What I want to do, and I spoke with the co-chair, and I'm sure that Joe's enjoying this, all these discussions with the Appropriations Committee, but I know you've been sitting here very patiently, and you may have things to do this afternoon like practice. Would you care to comment, obviously, on the AA? Do you have any comments or anything in general you'd like to share with the committee? And if you do, please identify yourself. It's always great to see somebody from Rock Springs in front of me. And the floor is yours. Sorry to just catch you off the cuff, but being a Division I college coach, you're ready for that.
Well, I'm not used to speaking to a microphone. My voice usually fills this room. But, Mr. Chair, thank you. I do have practice this afternoon. I will be leaving here shortly. But more importantly, I came over today to just see how things operate. Born in this state, graduated from high school. I am an alum. As I always tell people, I know where Yoder's at and Farson because I've spoke at both. So there's some things about me that are a little different. In regards to with the Arena Auditorium, I think it's a project that when we take a look at, the challenge for everyone here is to meet the needs. And as I listening to with our IT stuff, there is a shelf life. I took a great deal of pride in looking at the field house. I remember being able to play in there as a high school player and thought it was something else to walk out onto that university court. I witnessed a picture of it, and I forgot about the dirt on the court. I forgot about the mist in the air, and I understand why the arena needed to be built. And it's interesting how we forget about things when we enjoy them so much. And when I look at the AA, and I told my boss, Athletic Director Tom Berman, when we first started talking about this, that the life of the field house was 30 years, from 1952 to 1982. And he's way ahead of me in talking about things because he told me, you are not getting a new arena after 30 more years. And so what we're looking for and what I appreciate with this group, with the legislators, the governor, is that you have viewed that there needs to be an upgrade. And you have provided the resources to be able to do that for us. And when we started to have our meetings about this, I was asked the question from a coach, what do you need? I talked about I needed more practice space. Institutions are building practice facilities anywhere from $15 to $30 million. The house is just basketball. I didn't think that was justifiable. Senator Bebout, I'm a conservative person as well. And so I'm looking at where can we get the most bang for our dollar. The second question that was brought to me, as I said, we need to take care of the people of Wyoming. The Arena Auditorium, I believe more people will walk through that facility in a year's time and be able to witness things in that facility, whether it's through graduation, whether it's through special guest speakers when we had Gorbachev speak, or whether we have basketball games. It seems to be a focal point. And so I'm just very appreciative of what this group has done for us to put money in place, have a matching fund also to bring the Arena Auditorium into the next 30 years of existence for the University of Wyoming.
Mr. Chairman.
Co-chair.
Coach, appreciate your comments. And just a couple questions now. And we in this room, have kind of, it's difficult for the university administration to come and ask for upgrades to athletics, even though we understand, I mean, the Cowboys and Cowgirls are really the window to the university in many respects. So we've taken those political moves to do that, and we've secured the votes and the funding. You've done a great job of raising the money. But now, just anecdotally, I'm starting to hear, well, how come we're going from 15,000 seats to 11,500 seats? And I guess I'd like your take on that, and what's the history of that, and maybe some of your competitors, how big are their arenas, and is 11,500 seats? I understand you're going to have now actually four buckets to practice at instead of two. You'd mentioned that part, but what about the seating?
Well, the biggest thing I look at, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the biggest thing I look about with the seating is that as I view an arena, from a recruiting standpoint, young people want to see people in the facility. We have one of the largest arenas in the country outside the people that play in what I say off-campus facilities. We have more space. But what I realized as a fan when I went to watch our men play, that we have a video board on one end of the floor. My seats happen to have my back to the video board. By the time I turned around to watch the replay was done. And I thought, how nice would it be if I could see facing the court and see a replay on the other end. So to bring two video boards into the facility will help the fans' experience. You mentioned, Mr. Chair, about the Denver Broncos game tonight. The Denver Broncos put in $30 million in video enhancements to make the atmosphere better for their fan base. When I start thinking about things like that, that's when I start thinking about the people of Wyoming. And so reducing the amount of seats, I don't view as an issue. I know for women's basketball, was a little brash when I told them I'd fill the place. We did one time.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here for 10 years. We have filled it to capacity one time. When I take a look at that, I don't think the reductions of seats are going to be a problem. I watched a game the other night between the University of Florida, and they happened to be playing the University of Kansas. And it was packed. The students were down on the court. The atmosphere was tremendous. So I wanted to look up the seating capacity at the University of Florida, 11,500 seats.
Okay.
And all of a sudden it made me go, they have more population base to draw from. And all of a sudden that ticket probably became more valuable. I understand that. But that's a thing that they're looking at to fill on a daily basis rather than as we did on a one time with the WNIT championship.
Okay. You have a follow-up?
And then just, you know, and I don't know all the – I know one thing, and I've heard that the seats are actually part of that, though, is not so much the reconstruction. You're going to – like airlines have had to done, everybody's done over the last 30 years, seats have gotten a little wider. And is that part of this issue, too?
Mr. Chair, that is part of this issue. In the lower bowl, and I could probably have my boss speak better to this, but that the seats are going to go from about 18 inches to 22 inches, and I'm very happy to see that change.
I was going
to
say, as a
even though I have a great seat down in the front row,
yeah.
But that is part that is going to happen in the lower bowl to be able to do that. But I think the bulk of the seating that we may be losing is going to be due to the video boards. And where we're going to have two rather than one. They're also going to be larger, which is an important aspect as well.
I appreciate that. And as a former offensive lineman, those 18 inches are pretty tight. But
do you play offensive lineman? I thought you were a running back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Only in my dreams. My next question on that, where was I going with that?
You mentioned to him a running back, and he loses his train of thought. We'll have to remember that, Senators, when we're negotiating with a House chairman.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your help on that. And those are some of the things we're kind of hearing out there. And I guess, and I see A.D. Berman, you could, you know, part of the Gorbachev thing, you couldn't quite hear him. You know, it was a lighting issue, sound issue. Is that going to be addressed in this remodel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, absolutely. As part of this remodel, video, sound, lighting will all be made state-of-the-art technology. So with the Gorbachev situation, the graduations that we have in there where we have to bring in outside sound consultants, it'll be dramatically different and much improved, and we'll change the whole feel of it. And the other part, we are significantly enhancing the ADA seating in the arena, which will take quite a few of the seats out. But when you combine ADA seating, video boards, 22-inch seats versus 18-inch seats, that's where the majority, and the club area in Phase 2, that's where the majority of the 3,000-ish seat loss comes from.
Okay, so with those, I mean, that's part of the thing. It'll truly become an auditorium, the other part of the A and the in the AA. So, okay, I think I'm good, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Just a second. Okay, Reverend Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, two questions. One, will the $5 million that exists cover everything you're wanting to accomplish in Phase 2? That's the first question. Second question is, there's a lot of rumbling among the fans over the additional charges for the different levels of seatings. Could you address that and the logic behind that as well? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moniz, regarding the first part of your question, the $5 million will get us to the $30 million, assuming we raise the remaining $3.5 million we have to raise, which is would be double to seven to complete Phase 2, which I have no doubt we'll be able to complete. And so that will give us $30 million on Phase 1 and Phase 2, and we'll build a great renovation to the arena auditorium. With respect to the new seating plan, the university has tried over 30 years to implement a priority seating program off and on, and they always provided what I would call outs for people, grandfathering and different methods that people were allowed to escape paying for the best seats in the house. This renovation gives us an opportunity to hold everyone accountable, and if you're going to sit mid-court row two, you're going to pay $250 per seat plus the ticket. That is nothing in the industry. Joe and I spent hours talking with Coach Shiat and our ticketing people. The priority seating requirements will be very fair, and if not the lowest, near the lowest in the region. And there still will be seats available in the lower bowl where you do not have to make a donation. So there'll be $250 seat requirement, then there'll be another section of $125 seat requirement, and then there'll be a small section where there will not be a seat requirement, and anything above the concourse level, there is no requirement for a donation. And we have heard some concerns, but when we demonstrate to them what they're paying in Fort Collins or what they're paying in Utah State, they generally go, we understand.
Just one comment. Mr. Chairman, Tom, I think you guys have done an excellent job of explaining to the folks, but there has been a number of concerns expressed to me on that issue, and I understand the issues, and you've done an excellent job of explaining that to them, but like I said, there's some concerns.
We still have some education going forward, without a doubt.
We've kind of got off our schedule here a little bit, but while we're on this issue, I think we ought to get all the questions done. Senator Perkins?
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment that I was at that game when you had that WNIT championship against Wisconsin, and I've been to a lot of games at AA, and I don't ever remember it rocking like it was that night and Saturday afternoon, and that was great. You're off to a good 6-2 start this year, and we look to have good things from you. Thanks for coming,
Mr. Chairman. That wasn't quite the beer and bananas that we had back in the old days at the old auditorium.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I'd like to thank you for that compliment. It's interesting, and I want everybody here to know this. I've had a chance to speak to the freshman legislators a few years back, and one of the things that I told them, and I think your compliment leads right to this, is my job is to make you forget about your problems for 2 hours, and I was able to do that day. Your job is to solve the state's problems, and I thank you for that.
Any other? Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, one of the questions I had, I know there were a number of members of the committee that were sort of scratching their heads, is as we started talking to the university about budget, and then we saw the request, was why this wasn't originally part of that request. And, why is it a priority now? What happened in the interim?
Tom?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, it's always been a priority to me. All I can do is send it up the channels, and President Sternberg made the decisions he made, but the $5 million is essential to finish this project, and I guess I'll leave it at that.
Well, I only speak for one member of this committee, but if you start something, you ought to put the planning in it that's necessary, and if you're going to do it, you ought to do it right. And I think that's what we're trying to accomplish here. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just one more question on the size of the arena, and just because folks ask us, and I want to be able to have the facts. So our competitors in the Mountain West, similar size arenas, those kind of things.
Tom?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, yes. In fact, some smaller. Just looking down the list right here, I pulled some information. San Diego State, 12,414. Colorado State, 8,745. Boise State, 12,480. Utah State, 10,270. And probably the newest arena built in the West in recent recent years, and the hottest men's program in the West and one of the up-and-coming women's programs in the West is Gonzaga. They built a new arena 5 years ago, and they purposely built it at 6,000, capped it at 6,000 to create demand. Every night for the men is sold out, and they're getting close on the women's side. Obviously, in our league, New Mexico is a basketball-crazed market, 500,000 people in the Albuquerque area. They're at 16,000, some change with their renovation. So there are bigger. Utah's arena, the Huntsman Center, was built a few years before the University of Wyoming built the arena. In fact, they were modeled after each other. They are looking at a $40 to $60 million renovation and making their venue 10 to 12,000 seats.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions on the... Mr. Coach, go ahead. Mr. Chairman, and this won't be the appropriate time, but I think... And all these university resources and state resources that we try to leverage, I, as one member of the committee, I know there's probably challenges recruiting to 7,225. You've got a lot of Wyoming kids on your team, and duly noted, but I think, today won't be the time here, but I want to kind of understand some of these challenges of assistant coaches' pay. Some of the student services, summer school, nutrition, the whole kind of support system, what other Mountain West, what our competitors. We heard eloquently what, the star professors in Utah, how we're getting snatched away. And I want to kind of understand that in your realm as well. And, again, we're at the lunch period. We want to get you cut loose and get back to work. But those are issues that I kind of want to understand, and I think Maybe
you could work
more.
On something.
So,
is that what you're thinking?
Yeah,
could
thank you,
put
Mr.
something
Chairman.
Together for us in that regard.
That'd be great.
Would be helpful. And you might also, Tom, when you send some stuff to us, refer to those other areas. And I know that there's always something to be said about an arena, an event, whatever, that's sold out. And specifically, people go smaller so they'll have that feel. And I think that's what you're getting at. So anything you could provide us.
And that's right, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I wrote notes today. Wild star professors, and I've got some things cooking on this paper about those things. And so, it all begins with conversations, but I want to understand some of those challenges in the athletic realm as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on the AA while we're here? Any other questions in general of our coach or the athletic director while we're here? Because I don't think we'll let them get out of here. Any other questions that I was going to ask it. Tell me about the new football coach and the salary, where the money's coming from, how that works.
Coach Craig Bohl, head coach of North Dakota State, won back-to-back national championships, trying to win his third, is the new Wyoming football coach and will start as soon as his season ends. His contract is more aggressive than what we've done in the past regarding his base pay and his guaranteed compensation, not his total compensation. But his base pay is $300,000, which is section or state monies. His other guaranteed compensation, which comes from a litany of sources related to Cowboy Joe dollars, ticket revenue, TV revenue, etc., starts off at $450,000, increases by $50,000 a year per year. For the remaining 4 years of his contract. There is some incentive pieces in there. If he had a great year next year, I think he'll make over $1 million. So it's a great deal of money, but that is the market. And to secure the services of somebody with his experience who had coached at Nebraska, been a coordinator, had 11 years as a head coach, built a program, that was the market we had to play in. And in the past, we have limited our base pay to a level where there were oftentimes where I couldn't even get in the door to talk to coaches just because our guaranteed compensation wasn't competitive with the market. The high end in our market is in the Mountain West Conference right now is Colorado State. They're paying Jim McElwain, their football coach. His guaranteed compensation is $1.3 million. His base is $1.3 million. His compensation at the end of this year with a bowl game and some other incentives will be somewhere in the 1.6 neighborhood. That's the high end of the Mountain West. With Coach Bull's deal, he's probably behind Boise State, behind Fresno State, and then him, and then Wyoming. So we've made considerable progress.
How much did it cost us to buy out Coach Christensen's contract, and where'd that money come from?
That money all comes from Cowboy Joe revenue, and it's $570,000, and we paid the first half of it immediately, and then we have 30 days to pay the second half.
Just along that lines on Coach Bowles' contract, so the $300,000 guarantee is Section 1 money, and that $450,000 guarantee is not Section 1.
Section 2 money,
Section
correct.
Section 2. Okay.
Everybody got that?
That question's come up as well, so appreciate that.
And okay. And Rick negotiated the deal. Did I answer those correctly? He gave me thumbs up. So Rick was great behind the scenes helping us with the contract. So.
Yeah, and you got right after it, as you should have, and I compliment you on that. You know, it's everybody's pretty excited about it. It sure seemed like it. So we need some excitement in the football program. That's good. Reverend Stepson.
Mr. Chairman, just a little insight. My firm has offices in North Dakota, and I've been getting snotty emails ever since you did that. So I hope that's a good sign.
That kind of comes with the territory. Yes, Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, just to add briefly to what the athletic director said a moment ago, I was brought into this conversation on about November 16th. I think it was the day after President Sternberg resigned. And I just have to say that speaking as a business person and somebody interested in execution, this was masterfully planned and carried out. It was very well done.
Yeah, well done. You know, the neat thing about Wyoming is, and as Tom knows, you know, we have cell phone availability and calls happen at all hours and days, and so that's one thing about Wyoming. We'll continue to do that. Corporate pool, real quick, Light.
The governor did not include the phase two or level two planning funds, and I don't know how far I can go on that, but.
You know, that's your call, Tom.
I can answer questions regarding the pool.
Yeah, I understand. Any questions?
Was that amount, was that $500,000? I know it's in the budget, but just off memory.
Yes, it's $500,000, and that'll get us through the level two planning needs.
I guess just a quick question on the pool. It's probably in some narrative. And that was built when?
That was built in the 1950s. And has had some minor upgrades, but is obviously dated. And just a story to relay the situation we're getting into. The Air Force Academy had a dual meet in Laramie 2 weeks ago and called up Tom Johnson, our coach, and said they refused to swim in Corbett Pool. So we had to rent the rec center. Still not a very good pool, but a better pool than what we can offer. Boise State has been barking and saying they would like to swim against Wyoming in Denver at Denver University's pool. So at some point we're going to have to address it, and the sooner the better.
Okay. Anything else? You know, one thing I'll say, and we'll let you gentlemen get out of here, but Joe, you talked about the field house, and you mentioned the impact of it when you were young, and when I came down from Shoshone and we walked in there, we were playing, I can't remember, I might have been a freshman or a sophomore, and the first thing I saw were glass backboards. You know, we didn't have those in Shoshone. And there they were out in the middle of the field house. And we go, what
they
are
still
those
don't
square
have
things you can see through? And we didn't know what the hell to do with them. But anyway. Well, listen, thank you very much. I show us now 10 o'clock. What we'll do, Dick, is we will be back here at 1, and we're going to try to wrap it up. Where's Bill at? We'll try to wrap it up by 2, but we'll take what it takes. So we're in adjourn till 1 o'clock.